So just a little housekeeping note before we start. The registration desk is now open, so if you want to register for the ICANN conference, you can do that. Please note that you need a government-issued ID on you in order to complete the registration process. So don't do it now. You might do it during coffee or afterwards, but registration is possible as of now. So we would like to continue our discussion on how to best possibly structure our work for Workstream 1 by 2, I apologize, and I would like to invite Grace to shed a little bit of light on how drafting design teams have been worked in the CWG, and we should look whether we can cherry pick some of those ideas so that we get closer to getting sort of a straw man project management approach for the various work items to be dealt with in Workstream number 2. And without further ado, I would like to hand over to Grace, please.
Thank you, Thomas. So as we prepare to structure the work for Workstream 2, the chairs had asked me to do a quick introduction on how we got through our toughest part of the CWG stewardship. The way we did that, there are some differences, so I'll explain the CWG process, and then, of course, the CCWG may discuss adapting that a little bit differently. We picked up, following the ICANN meeting in Singapore last year, we decided to change our work methods, and we adopted a method that we borrowed from the IETF using what we call design teams. They were small groups of volunteers with specific expertise on specific subjects. So these groups were under 10 people, and they worked on different time frames, and with they had different lengths in their life cycle. So the way we started this out was after the Singapore meeting, the chairs put together a proposal or a sort of a template, and then asked different members of the CWG to propose design teams based on different topics that they wanted to work on. And as part of the proposal, they had to put together a list of Brenda, if you can scroll down to the template, I can go through that quickly. So I put together a version for the CCWG. It may not be how we want to work with it, but I based it off of how the CWG template was designed. So they put together a little background. They put together some information. So in the CWG's case, there was information that we pulled from the IANA contract, which doesn't apply here. So I modified that for this group and suggested maybe something called, existing work areas documentation. This could also be the issue report or the pre-work that Alan mentioned earlier today. And then the third part of this template would be some kind of a work plan, a time frame, request for resources that may be different for each group or each topic. And then the last part would be some sort of a composition or expertise needed notice. So in the CWG's case, there were certain groups that required certain types of expertise, some that were more security-focused, more budget-focused, et cetera. So either the individual proposing the design team already had a few people in mind, or that person would put in the request for certain expertise in their proposal, and then we would turn that proposal out to the CWG for them to volunteer if they had that expertise. So what we did is we had a proposal period for a few weeks. There were about 15 design teams proposed by the different members of the CWG, and the chairs then we made sure the templates were filled out, had as much information as needed, and then the chairs went through those templates and proposed a sort of prioritization or sequencing of work, if that's a word. sequencing. There's a sequence to the work that was established based on the 15 design teams. So not all 15 design teams ran at the same time. We started with a few that we thought would run longer than others. There were a few that closed sooner than others, and we structured the work that way. All the work from the design teams was fed back into the plenary group. The plenary group made decisions about whether that work was acceptable or not, whether they had questions or not, whether the drafting met their requirements or not, and then all of those mini design teams then fed into the larger report. So that's how we structured the work with the CWG. Brenda, if you can scroll down a little bit more, I put together, this template is just, the information, but if you scroll down, I did a quick example of what that template could look like. Of course, there's not enough information probably in there based on the conversation we had today. If you maybe if you can zoom out and then we can show the template. I'll circulate this to the list as well. But I did this example for the SOAC accountability topic. The background I pulled from the report, Workstream 1 Annex 12, and then put some questions and some potential, expertise needed, things like that. So this template may be adjusted. It may be different for the CCWG. Our process around the work may be different as well, but it's just an example of how we proceeded with the CWG.
Thanks very much, Grace. Does anyone have a question for Grace? If I missed some, Steve, please.
Thanks, Steve Dobianco. Grace, the design of the design team said no more than three at the same time. I think that was based on staff limit, or was it participants? And then, in fact, did you have more than three running at the same time at any point?
Yeah, so I think, I pulled these guidelines from what the CWG had originally proposed. We did have more than three running at different times. I'm not sure how many were running, what's our maximum. I think at one point we may have had five or six running, but the frequency was different. Some of them had meetings twice a week. Some had meetings once every month. So it depended on the work methods of the group. We encouraged the groups to work on their mailing list. We had set up mailing lists for each group, and we encouraged them to work on their mailing list, but some groups worked better on the phone and using Adobe Connect.
And to clarify, if staff becomes the scarce resource as opposed to volunteers, if the working method is email, staff isn't involved unless they're getting questions. Staff gets involved, though. It's scheduling and staffing a call, right?
That's correct.
Thanks very much. Cavus?
Yes, I have no difficulty with the concept, but perhaps we should look whether we need to say design, because they don't design anything. They're just working some process. Perhaps that is not the issue. The issue I want to raise, I hope that this design team or whatever you call them would not compromise the openness and inclusiveness of the activities in the ICANN. Should not prevent anybody, because first of all, it's difficult to somebody say that you are not expert, because the first one who say you are not expert, he should be expert. So I don't know who is going to make that decision that you are or are not expert. If it remains open and inclusive, I have no problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Cavus. Paul?
Yes, I just want to ask, it's a similar question to Cavus. Why was this magic number 10 devised?
So, yeah, these are just, they were suggestions. At the time, so the CWG came up, we wanted a small, manageable group. We thought 7 to 10 was manageable for a small group, and I think that was the idea behind 10. So it doesn't have to be 10, and we don't have to have just three running. These were just numbers that were developed in the process. I wanted to quickly touch on one point. I forgot to mention that in some cases we did have where there was expertise needed that extended beyond what we had available in the volunteer group. We did reach out to experts on staff and experts that were outside of the working group in some cases. And in particular for the budget group, Xavier, who's in the back of the room, helped a lot with framing the questions and providing information. And for the what we call now the RZERC, We had David Conrad come in with some expertise in the root zone system. So there we go.
Andrew, and then Alan.
Thank you. It's Andrew Sullivan here. So I just want to pick up on something that Grace said, because I think part of the reason that this got suggested, there's some questions that people have been asking, and Grace mentioned that I think this got started because I believe it was Avery who suggested that the CWG could adopt this, and it's a thing that worked from somewhere else. So in the IETF, we use design teams when we've got contentious stuff, and we need to get a very small number of people to just come up with some proposal. And the whole point is to get a very small number of people to come up with some concrete proposal so you have one thing to work from. And that's the reason for the small number of people. I think maybe we can all concede that this group has demonstrated that drafting with 130 of your closest friends is not the most efficient way to produce a proposal, for the first pass. And so the idea of the design team is that they come up with a concrete thing, and then you can start hammering on that text. And that's a really helpful, I thought that worked really well in the CWG from what I saw. So I like this idea. If people want to make progress on the Workstream 2 stuff, it seems it might be helpful.
And Alan, Andrew, just to piggyback on that, I think the other thing that worked really well for the CWG that may not apply or may be different for the CCWG was that the topics the CWG was working on or were working on were very specific, and they were couched in, at least for the most part, clauses in the IANA contract. So the work was very specific. If you look at the list of topics we have for Workstream 2, that work is much more broad. So there may be a question there as to how you frame the questions and whether you need multiple design teams for within different topics.
Alan?
Thank you. A couple of things I guess I have to say. What Grace described was the theory. And in practice, the concept of experts did not always apply, and it morphed into those with interest. So I think it's really important not to focus on the experts. It didn't quite apply there, and it probably will apply less here. We may not be all experts on some of the issues in Workstream 2, but some of us have some strong interests. So that's number one. Number two, as Grace said, they were designed to do a bit of work and then disappear. One of them is still actively working. So it didn't quite all work that way. So let's be flexible if we use something that, this is not a formula that has proven itself perfectly and has to be replicated exactly. With regard to Andrew's comment that in the IETF it's used as a small group of people to formulate something which then the larger group tears apart, in general in the CWG, the group did a good enough job that there was little tearing apart. There was discussion. There were changes because of it. Here we're perhaps more likely to find, because of the breadth of the issue, that that's less likely to happen. But again, just keep in mind, if we're going to try a methodology, I don't know if it's not rocket science or it is rocket science. We're going to try something and hope it works, and we may have to modify it as we go along. Let's just keep flexible. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Cavus?
Could we have a combination of both, either expert or interested? Thank you.
Thanks, Cavus. Let me just check whether there are any further wishes to speak from those who are not in the Adobe. That doesn't seem to be the case. I guess we should understand this exercise presented by Grace as inspiration for what we could use. You know, it's not, we don't have to use this on a verbatim basis. So what I understand is that we should not, it looks like everyone likes the concept, right? So that I haven't heard any disagreement on that, on using this approach. But we need to specify whether we need experts or not, depending on the subject matter. I guess that's up for the subteams to define, or for our group to define. We don't have to insist on making those groups work for a short period of time, but they can work for a longer period of time. We might have multiple of those design teams inside some of these Workstream 2 items. So it may well be that, let's say, the jurisdiction group sets up design teams to work on different aspects of jurisdiction where different skill sets are required. So we're not prescriptive on that, but you will remember that we didn't set the expectation for this week to come up with solutions for everything that needs to be done in Workstream 2, but to agree on working methods and approaches. So I think this feedback is welcome. Grace, thanks again for this presentation. That's very valuable. So let's put that into our box of tools that we have. We actually have another document which is hopefully available to be displayed in the AC room, and that's a little bullet point list on things that we might go through for each of the Workstream 2 items. So let me pause for a second. More hands raised. Steve.
Thank you. I wanted to make an observation is that the design team approach that was described, had we known about it 14 months ago, we would have said that's what we did. We didn't have a name for it. But Work Team 1 and Work Area 1, Work Area 2, Jordan, remember this? When we first met in Singapore, we did exactly that. We did a mailing list-based document prep and discussion. But I want to add that what focused us on the deliverable was the co-chairs saying to the rapporteurs, week from Tuesday, need you guys to be able to present. You're second on the agenda. We need you to present your inventory of accountability. Or Jordan, we need you to be able to present the escalation process. And those opportunities of presenting to the full CCWG, not as something that's final, but even a work in process, they ended up focusing the efforts towards a draft we could all say we're ready to present. But it's very familiar, what you've described. And it was a mailing list driven with occasional calls, plus the closure and urgency of having to make a deadline for a presentation.
Thanks, Steve. Cavus, I guess that was an old hand, right? New hand?
Yes, I think perhaps we should not go into too much detail of how these different working group manage their work. Whether you should have designed or not designed one or two, leave it to them according to the circumstances, needs they have established one, two, or three. So we should just go to the highest level, and then the remaining would be left to them to decide.
Correct. As I said, we don't want to be prescriptive, but we just want to agree on acceptable working approaches, working methods with this group. So can we maybe have this small bullet point list up in the Adobe? That would be great.
And the bullet point list would be in some ways a different way to phrase to work on a work plan or a template. So we may not need the template as proposed there, or we may adjust the template based
Correct.
On that list,
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, I can hardly recognize what's on the screen there because it was just a very ugly list of bullet points, and our excellent staff has magically transformed this into something beautiful in a matter of an hour or so. So basically what we would suggest doing for all the Workstream 2 items, if you agree, is follow this five-step approach that follows the themes that we've heard earlier in these discussions. So basically, we would establish a sub-team or a working group first. That's the first step, that we set up a group to deal with a Workstream 2 item. Then this group would itself select a coordinator. So we need someone who is, or multiple individuals that take responsibility for work products being produced and delivered, and for them to be produced on time. We would ask them to establish an inventory of material available on the topic inside the CCWG. We would ask them to check work underway previously conducted outside the CCWG that would, for example, cover other initiatives working on human rights or other initiatives working on the ombudsman and so on and so forth in order to ensure that there is no duplication of efforts and no spending of funds unnecessarily. They would then propose the scope of work to the CCWG and establish a list of requirements. This is pretty much what we've done when we started the CCWG work. We did the inventory and we established requirements. And there will surely be requirements for transparency. Robin has mentioned some areas of concern for transparency earlier this morning. But, you know, that would be the second step. And then the CCWG would review and adopt the scope and requirements. And this is to ensure that basically the groundwork is done in the sub-teams or in the drafting teams or whatever name we might give them. But full control over where this is going is maintained in the CCWG, i.e. the plenary CCWG. And after that, they're going to prepare a draft report for the CCWG, and if the CCWG is okay with the report, then it's going to be put out for public comment. And after the public comment period is conducted, there would be a review and the adoption of a draft. We would then put out the final report for public comment if necessary, analyze and consider the results of the public comment period, and define next steps for the working group. And that pretty much depends on the subject in question. So that's basically a straw man project plan that we could apply for all the work areas. And I would like to open it up for questions or comments from your side. So basically the idea is, irrespectively of when the different topics are started, they would all go through these stages, so that we have a unique or a standard working approach for all the sub-teams. And that helps us if we allocate time to that. Let's say T0 is the starting point for the working group. We would allocate time slots, right? You have three, let's say 1 month for phase one, and then we would give time to the other phases. And if we do that for all the exercises, that helps us balance the workload, that helps us synchronize the work with ICANN's meeting schedule so that people can make best use of face-to-face time, and so on and so forth. There are hands raised. Steve, and then Cavus.
Thanks, Thomas. Steve Del Bianco. Earlier we discussed how staff would contribute to the scheduling of calls, but I'm looking at step two there and wondering if there are other ways ICANN staff can be of assistance. If, for instance, we were looking at the jurisdictional work stream 2 thread, is there anything staff can do in terms of research and problem definition during step 2?
I think that's an excellent point. The idea of step 2 is actually to collect all the information that is required in order to do a drafting exercise. So we can easily add, and I suggest that we do so, the idea that was brought up by Alan to have a desk research, sort of what the folks familiar with GNSO policymaking call the issues report. And that is a report, a research that's conducted by ICANN staff before, in the case of the GNSO Council takes a decision on whether or not a PDP should be initiated in order to inform that very decision. Steve, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I'm familiar with how we've done it in GNSO, and you're right, issues report would fit nicely in too. So let me ask about timing and staff availability. If, for instance, we did jurisdiction, legal jurisdiction, how long would it take for staff to prepare an issues report? And sometimes that's a function of how much detail's in it, right? Because sometimes issue reports in GNSO can be 2 months in the making, right? So we could potentially time box to say, staff, give us the best issues report you can within 6 weeks. Give us the best issues report you can within 3 weeks. And that would at least give a head start to the process. But we could adjust that depending on the expectation of timing.
Thanks, Steve. And maybe we should mark as an action item for staff to give us an indication of how much time they would need for issues reports on the subject areas for Workstream 2. I see Sam's hand is up, but before we move to Sam, let's hear Cavus, Grace, and then Sam.
Yes, I think it sounds good. It may change from topic to topic, but we leave it as it is. We don't change it. My question is that about 5.4. Why in 5.4 we say define next step for working group? Do we open a Pandora box going back again to working group? So could you clarify number 5.4, please? Thank you.
Sure. You're entirely correct that 5.4 is a little bit loose, but the reason for that is that what's going to happen in 5.4 depends on the feedback from the public comments. So it may well be that the CCWG finds out that we have forgotten about an important aspect, and then maybe the CCWG hands back the report to the working group to further refine it, or the work product is great, it's going to be finalized, and the group is just wound down. So that's possible. It may also be that this is, you know, being handed over to follow-up work. You know, we said that some work is building on other work, so we wanted to maintain the flexibility intentionally on that point. Do you have a follow-up question, Cavus?
Follow-up question. Perhaps in 5.4 we could say taking required action as appropriate. Thank you.
I'm perfectly fine with adding that. Grace?
I'll lower my hand. I'll defer to Sam as the staff liaison.
Staff. Sam, please.
Sure. Thank you. So this is partially in response to the question that Steve raised in terms of timing, and then you followed up on for staff to develop these types of issue reports or pre-work. I think some of it depends on the sequencing of when you'd need it. We'd also need to understand the full scope of the issues that would be expected to be within the issues report. So if those were the items, so it would be one thing if we could rely on what was in the Workstream 2 portion, or if there were additional questions that are related to the topic that would need to be answered. Those all impact the scope of potential research that we might need to do that would go into a timing estimate. And so if it's a takeaway for staff to come back with different time frames that it would need for producing the issue reports on the different topics that are identified for Workstream 2, it would be helpful if we had a confirmation. At this point, we should go by the parameters that are currently within the Workstream 2 appendix of the report.
That's a great point, Sam. I think we might face a little bit of chicken and egg here, because usually, as you rightfully pointed out, the scoping should take place first, so that those researching know what to research on. At the same time, the scope of the report might depend on the findings of the research. So maybe we should have two phases of scoping: one, initial scoping to inform the scope of the issues report or the desk research that you're conducting, and then the group would do a second phase of scoping in order to inform its own work. Jordan.
Thanks, Thomas. Just to add another dimension to this, which I think is a workable way of doing things. We could add in our planning and understanding of what we want to discuss at which ICANN meeting. So I think we should use the face-to-face ICANN meetings as a chance to get community input and thought in response to stuff we do. So we've got a meeting in June and somewhere, probably in June, and we've got a meeting in October and then next March. So there are three sort of within the next year, there are three opportunities to get the ICANN community to consider these issues face-to-face, and I think we just have to put that in the mix. We shouldn't organize our work in a way that accidentally misses the opportunity of when everyone is together offering input and being able to understand where our thinking is at.
Good point, Jordan. I guess that we will need some brains to work on the initial scoping. Part of that can be drawn from the archives of our working group, because we've been discussing these things preliminary earlier. But what I think we need to do now, and that's sort of the takeaway from this session, first of all, is let's try to take stock that this is a working approach that we like, and I haven't seen any objection. So if you think that this five-step approach that we're suggesting combined with the design team approach is not something that we should take as our repertoire of tools to deploy when we're working, then please do speak up now. Yes, and there's a hand raised. Sebastian.
Yeah, I see some discussion on the chat. There is already, I guess, one page or two page on each topic, because the work conduct under the leadership of Leon about the work stream 2, we write a page or two on each topic. It's why it's signed up to be topic for work stream 2. I remember that we spent some time in discussion about diversity, about accountability, and so on and so forth. And we have already some document we share with this within this working group. Then it could be a good start for each of them. Thank you.
Good point. Let's add that. So there doesn't seem to be any objection. So let's conclude that. Also, we will, as a leadership team, try to come up with a sketch of how things could be planned for let's say the next 12-15 months. So we come up with a rough idea of a project plan. We need some people to work on these things. So we need to launch a call for volunteers. And I think that our prioritization will depend on whether we find sufficient volunteers for all of these exercises. And I think that the group will also guide us with the level of response to the different topics as to what they think needs to be worked on first and what can be worked on later. So we suggest that we launch a call for volunteers soon. We will prepare an invitation in writing that will be spread to the community through the chartering organizations, but also there should be a public announcement so that we can get interested people lined up. Eberhard, your hand is raised.
Yes, eberhardlisse.na. Can I suggest that we set a limit for number of working groups a volunteer can participate in so that not the same people sit on every group?
I think that's an excellent suggestion, and actually it's a point that we've discussed during our preparations for this meeting. And now that you mention it, we can disclose that, for example, we would not want an individual to chair or to be the coordinator for more than one group, right? Also, we want to have different people with different expectations, with different backgrounds, working on the groups. I think we can't prescribe too much at this stage, so let's try to get people's interest first. And if we see that the balance is just entirely inappropriate, then we might need to step in. There's another hand raised by Jan and then Grace.
Yeah, no, Jan Schulte, it was just to ask what sort of specific measures you were thinking about in terms of the outreach to make sure that new blood and fresh faces and new ideas and beyond CCWG get involved in these Workstream 2 debates.
Well, certainly that's not only for me to decide, but I would assume that we communicate to the chartering organizations, to the ICANN constituent groups, if you wish. We should have an announcement on ICANN's website, and I would hope that ICANN will use its social media channels also to solicit volunteers for this exercise. And any ideas that you might have are more than welcome. Grace?
Yeah, to Eberhard's point and to Steve's point earlier, one of the reasons why on the CWG side there was a limit to the amount of DTs that were, you know, active was because there are a few people, and more than a few, who wanted to participate in multiple design teams. And so the idea was to manage the volunteer workload by structuring and sequencing the design teams so that every volunteer had the opportunity to participate, but not necessarily in all of them at the same time.
Thanks, Grace. Oh, there's a queue forming. That's interesting. Malcolm.
Thank you. I agree with Eberhard's point insofar as you responded to it, namely that it would be best to avoid having the same people in... Sorry, I beg your pardon. I'd agree with Eberhard's point in as far as you responded to it, namely that it's best to avoid having the same people at chairing or in leadership roles in multiple working groups to the extent possible. However, I would take a principled objection to going further in the way that I thought Eberhard might have been suggesting, namely, we should not prevent anyone who wishes to take part in these groups from taking part.
Understood. Thanks, Malcolm. Bruce?
Thanks, Thomas. Just an observation, I guess. The board has had a similar challenge each year when we look at board committees. So we have quite a few committees. We have some committees that everyone wants to be on, some committees that nobody wants to be on. So we try to balance that. So, and our general sort of rule of thumb that as a member, and we also distinguish members from, let's say, observers or participants, but we set the membership of committees so that you're not a member of more than two committees and you're essentially a chair of only one committee, for example. But the other thing that we look at when we form those committees is balance. So you want to make sure you've got a balance of views and perspectives on each of these working groups. So, you know, if you have a working group that's looking at, transparency and it's all the people from the sort of non-commercial side that have expertise in that area, but you don't have any business people on there, you know, I don't think you have balance. I think you want to make sure that you've got some balance in your selection. So my recommendation is you might want... Oh, and the third comment, the other problem we've had at the board level when we set up committee structures is then trying to schedule a meeting. So at one stage several years ago, we had, you know, half the board that were pretty much members of everything, and it meant that you had to have 3 days of meetings because it was impossible to schedule anything in parallel. Likewise, the teleconferences, you know, there's only certain slots that sort of at optimal times of the day or night when you've got to get the maximum participation, and then if you have every group trying to use the same slot, you're not productive. So try and make sure that you have the actual members that are spread across and you're not members of more than two. And then as Malcolm points out, just as we have on the board, anyone can turn up and participate in a meeting and listen. But in terms of the actual members, when you're trying to schedule a call, it's helpful if you're not members of more than two things at once and where you absolutely must be able to attend the meeting.
Thanks very much, Bruce. Jorge?
Hello. Thank you, Jorge Gancia, for the record. I was just wondering, and perhaps it's more a comment or a question, whether there is any provision for structured involvement of the CCWG advisors into this work, because probably in the framing of the issues, they could not only provide us with their expertise, which is important, but also with a fresh view sometimes. So I was wondering whether there could be a way to structure this involvement a bit more than in Workstream 1. Thank you.
Thanks, Jorge. I think that's an excellent point, and I'm seeking eye contact to two of the advisors that we have in the room. I see nodding from here. Jan is still a bit shy, but he's also nodding. And I suggest that we take note of that suggestion. Nonetheless, I think it would be good for the sub-teams to then agree on a working or on a method of interaction with the advisors. But I think it's excellent to tap on their expertise in this phase as well. Next in line is Siva.
My suggestion is to pay attention both to the continuity aspects of those involved in work stream 2, in the work of work stream 1 and the work of stream 2. And at the same time, pay attention to significant diversity, new blood. And, when new board members are seated, there is a ceremonial process of dissolving the previous board and recreating a new board? And is there such a process? And if there is such a process, if there is such a ceremony between in transition of work from stream one to stream two, then I think both the continuity of those involved can be ensured, as also some fresh thinking and external advice can be brought in. Thank you.
Thanks, Siva. Cavus and then Jan.
Yes, on the participation of advisor, it was made, I think it is legal advisor, it should be some sort of provision that participation of advisor are welcome, but it's costly. It takes time, money. So it should be some approval of that, either by the chair of the group, or I don't know what does it mean in respect of the costs. Thank you.
Cavus, we're not talking about the legal advisors, but about the advisors picked by the public expert group. And if they get money, then at least it hasn't been brought to our attention yet. Jan, are your pockets full of dollars?
I can absolutely guarantee you I have not become a penny richer out of this. just on the advisors, otherwise, though, maybe not only think about the advisors you've got at the moment. There are issues like the human rights where I think outside the current group of advisors you could get better advice.
That's a good point. And just Alan reminds me that I should clarify that the travel and accommodation has been picked up for the public expert advisors, but they're not being paid for their consultancy.
Some of us are covering that as well.
Okay, some of them are even covering that. So, yes, I do know. Yeah. So, it looks like Sebastian wants to speak.
Yeah, just to tell you, it's Sebastian Bachelet speaking. Thomas, you need to say each time you talk that you are Thomas, because in the report it's always Leon, and sometimes Thomas. But when you are speaking, if you don't say Thomas, you will not be recognized, and that's a pity.
I've asked the scribes to attribute all the bad sentences to Leon and all the good ones.
That's why. But you are saying a lot of bad sentences since the beginning of the meeting, Thomas.
This is Thomas Rickert for the record. And I think this has been a good conversation about how we can structure the work in order in terms of project management for those areas that need legal advice. We will, in our preliminary proposal for project management for all these, include feedback loops with the lawyers. That will also enable us to do cost control, so there won't be infinite possibilities to interact with the lawyers, but we need to structure that in a way that they are being presented with specific questions, and then there's one or two feedback loops with the lawyers, and that is it, so that we can predict what the cost would be. We will ask them for quotes more than we did during this initial phase, but you will see all that. We will come back to the group with a proposal. But now we would like to use the time that we have together on exchanging ideas on what the substance of the Workstream 2 discussions should be. And in order to do that, I would like to hand over to Leon.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This is Leon Sanchez, and I won't say bad sentences. And if I do, please attribute them to Thomas. So we're trying to carry out an exercise here about a scoping of the different issues that we'll be covering on Workstream 2. So what we would like to hear is from all of you the different ideas that you have about which topics or how to further develop and flesh out the different topics that we have for Workstream 2. We have heard, for example, from Steve that maybe the last four issues could be encompassed in other efforts that are being undertaken throughout the ICANN structure. So that's helpful. And I think we could elaborate on this in this group, and we could share our thoughts as to which way we should be directing our work. So at this point, I would like to open the floor for all of those who have ideas or comments about the topic of diversity. And, of course, we would welcome any suggestions as to how to better drive the scope of this working group in diversity. So I see that there are two hands already on. I see Bruce and Jorge, but I'm not sure if those are all hands. Okay, so then Eberhard would be the first one. Eberhard?
Eberhard Lisse, for the record. You mentioned you're starting with diversity. Should we not perhaps discuss in what order we should proceed first? I'm not sure. I have no position on this. Whether diversity is the one to start with, but there have been concerns. Robin Gross would like to start with human rights framework or something. Maybe we should discuss in what order we. And I think we should do the ombudsman last. Maybe we should actually first before we discuss individual things to decide what order we are going to go.
Thank you very much, Eberhard. These are, of course, not meant to be in any priority at this point, so that's why we just put them into the slide without prioritizing, and I understand that some people might want to prioritize at this point, but I suggest that if we, our vision is that if we begin prioritizing at this stage, we might get lost into that discussion, and it wouldn't really take us to having a fruitful outcome at this point. So, if anyone is against just going on the suggested order, the random order that we have on the slide, or if there is any opposition to that, is there any opposition to going in the order that is in the slide on these topics? Caboose?
Yes, Leon, I never oppose to the chair, but I think most important item is human rights, after that jurisdiction, and then ombudsman, and then list the others. Human rights was the first, and then after that jurisdiction, and then put ombudsman, and the remaining on the list, depending on the situation. So, not opposing to you, but just suggesting another order of priority. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to discuss all of them. In fact, so why don't we begin with something easy? Human rights. Okay, so joking aside, could we have some input on human rights? Let's begin with human rights. Can we have some input from you on human rights as to which way we should be scoping or which would be the scope for this subgroup on human rights? And now the floor is open, and I see Jorge, is that an old hand, Jorge Cancio? I don't know if Jorge is... I don't see him, so I think it's an old hand. So the first hand is Paul Toomey. Paul?
Thanks, Leon. There's been quite a discussion about human rights on the CCWG list for the last months. And I think simply a search to that will give you some of the criteria. I think a general perspective that human rights are a good thing, but the difficulty has been around several ones. First of all, to which functions of ICANN's operations and policy making do we wish this to apply? That's one of the key issues. Second question has been what set of rights? The third one has been are there models for implementation? And there's been a lot of discussion of the pros and cons of the RUGI principles at the UN level. And there may well be, if I'm to understand the suggestion of other experts being particularly available, there might be other models that are out there in international organisations to look to. So that's my understanding of the scoping of the working group.
Thank you very much, Paul. Next on the queue, I have Niels Tenhoever. Niels.
Thank you very much. This is Niels Tenhoever for the record, also the chair of the Cross-Community Working Party on ICANN's Corporate and Social Responsibility to Respect Human Rights and participant in Working Party 4. And I think that we actually have a pretty clear way forward, and I'd like to build on what Paul said before, is that we have a very clear set of things that we need to work on in Annex 12. with a clear set of questions. And I again agree with Paul that it's first very important to understand what we're exactly talking about. Well, luckily, in the cross-community working party, we've been also trying to deal with this question, and luckily there's also a standard for that, and that's called a human rights impact assessment. And we'll present during our session on Monday a potential model in which we could go forward with that, and I think that would be a constructive way forward to understand where ICANN impacts human rights positively or adversely, and then we understand the playing field much better, and then subsequently, but that's further down the road, then we could see what different kinds of models would fit to that, whether that would be RUGI, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, which are often also referred to as the RUGI principles after the leader of the working group, John RUGI, or the UN Global Compact, or many other standards that are out there in the industry. So I would not go ahead into the discussion of how, but first try to properly map what and agree on a method for that. And I think a human rights impact assessment could be one of that, and I am very eager and willing to contribute to that process.
Thank you very much for that, Niels. Next on the queue, I have Alan Greenberg.
Thank you. Much of what I was going to say has already been referenced, so I've got to re-script myself on the fly. I'm not an expert in human rights, and I'm the first to admit that. It's really important that whatever we end up doing gets wide buy-in, including from those who are not experts on human rights. And the kind of scoping we just heard about of just what does human rights mean within ICANN's limited scope is a really important issue, and it's got to be put in words that those of us who are not experts understand. And I think it's in, that reiterates my earlier comment saying we need the prep work done ahead of time, and maybe the CCWG that Niels referenced is doing some of that. Even if whatever statements are made are going to be controversial, and I suspect some of them will be, it's really important to get things down so that we can all, you know, critique it and work from there. It's an area which is clearly important in the real world and clearly not well understood within ICANN just what it means from our perspective. You know, where are the areas that not having such a statement in place means we have violated human rights? Are there such areas? How do we go about rectifying them? What is the impact of those? I think it's got to be understood widely, not just by the experts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. This is absolutely useful because sometimes when speaking about rights, we tend to use big words that not many people actually understand. So it's very important that we, whatever the outcome we produce from this group, has is produced in a language, in common language, that people without great knowledge in human rights may be able to understand. So next on the queue, I have Avri Doria. Avri.
Thanks. Avri speaking. I'm not going to repeat. I think the things that were said about what that group should be working on were good. One of the things that I did want to address was the conversation that has gone on in the chat about, well, there are other groups working on human rights within ICANN. Maybe we shouldn't reinvent wheels. We should just let them do it. First of all, I've never been against reinventing wheels. That's how we get better ones. But they have broader scope in some sense than I think the specifically scoped, as was written in the report, WS2 questions. And so, and also there's a group in the GAC, and there's the Human Rights Working Party that has some of the SOAC in it, but by no means all. And I think for the Workstream 2 effort, it's really important that those groups continue to contribute, continue to feed information, arguments, what have you, into the Workstream 2 effort. But I really do believe that we need to have an effort that specifically targets the questions and issues of that framework. that was requested in, you know, that got in during Workstream 1. So I just wanted to speak to that particular issue.
Thank you very much for that, Avery. That is also very useful. Next on the queue, I have Cavus. Cavus Arista.
Yes, I think the first thing that input to the human rights is in paragraph 172, our reports or a proposal of the CCWG. Second, I think we should think whether we need to have this multiple group, GAC working of human rights, GNSO working of human rights, CCNSO human rights, and so many things. Why not we put all them together and have one area that all experts coming there and talk about the human rights, unless we are talking of different human rights. Human rights for the GTLD, human rights for the this and this, so on and so forth. So is it this parallel working is required? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. I have Avery and then Eberhard. So, Avery?
Sorry, I can't defer.
Or was Eberhard
before? I wanted to have a go at this.
Okay.
As much as I'm not against talking to others and getting information, this is a work stream item that we decide we need to do, which means we need to do this. I'm also not worried about the budget. We have all the money we need. We may be a little bit careful in spending it, but we cannot have, again or whatever, have decisions be subject to availability of funds. We will make the decisions as we see fit, and we will try to make it in as small a budget as possible. But I'm totally against of trying to fob off things that we decide that we push from Workstream 1 to Workstream 2 with a little bit of heartbreak, and with a specific condition attached that we will attempt it, that we now say, no, April, we can fob this off on somebody else. That really would irritate me.
Thank you very much, Abad. Avery?
Yes, thank you. To build on what was just said, I think that we're having all these efforts in all these separate places because these groups have different concerns on human rights. And I don't think that we want to try the whole boil, the whole ocean of human rights in this Workstream 2 effort. We have a very specific build a framework. I think within the working party, we're going to be looking at issues related to specific PDPs. I think in GAC, they're going to be looking at human rights directed to various specific issues that are under discussion. Sure, they'll be contributing to this Workstream 2 framework issue, but there's also the current issues that are being discussed, and I think that would be much too much of an ocean boil for achieving the Workstream 2 effort.
Thank you very much, Avery. Next on the queue, I have Eric. Come on.
It's difficult between all of what is to find a mic here. What I would love to do is to talk about the issue maybe and frame it in a little bit different way. I was part in the last years and many years, 20 years actually, where I worked on internet legislations. And the most recent decisions the European Court of Justice took, where many of them which impacted internet companies, were actually based on human rights relations. So it's a very sensitive and a very problematic issue. And it's not easy, actually, for ICANN to find a way to frame it in such a way that we will not impacted by it without knowing negatively. So I would say we should, when we frame the topic, we should have somebody who is really experienced. I'm not just talking about the European, but this goes much beyond Europe. I'm just taking the ECG decision as one example. So I think we should invite somebody who is really knowledgeable in this field from a legal point of view to tell us what it means if we include reference to human rights and what it would mean if we don't do it. Because both examples are interesting because we have to apply human rights standards anyhow independently if we frame it and have it part of our part of our ecosystems, but if we include it, it probably might have a different meaning. So I think we should have somebody, invite somebody who is really knowledgeable in this area and is an expert in our field. So I think it's not helpful to have a lawyer looking into it who never worked in this field, but somebody who is knowledgeable and understands the domain name world and somebody who really can understand and investigate what this means, what we are doing. And the second, I think, coming to what Avri said, I think I agree with her in many ways. I just would love to have first somebody looking into it and give us, you know, from a more objective and neutral perspective. And then I think it might be easier for us to frame the topic.
Thank you very much, Erica. So what I'm listening on this discussion is that the orientation of the discussion should also be mindful of which operational aspects of ICANN do we relate with the human rights discussion, that to take into account the different models of implementation that have been discussed both on the mailing list and in the working party that took care of the discussion on human rights, whether it's drugging principles, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, etc. So we need to define that framework. We also need to take into account what is the potential impact of ICANN's actions in human rights, and that will also be part of the discussion and the output. And we also need to build upon the work that other groups have done already, because we don't want to duplicate efforts. We don't want to duplicate our work, of course. We don't want to reinvent the wheel, as Avery was putting it. So we should be mindful of what work we can take advantage of, what work can be reused to feeding into this subgroup's work. And we, of course, need to define human rights within ICANN's limited scope. What are we talking about? We need to not only name the beast, but we have to describe the beast. So this is also another task that we will be undertaking in this working group. And the clearer the language for others that are not experts in human rights, the more welcome the outcome. So we will be trying to conduct this work in very clear and understandable language. And we also need to avoid broadening the scope of this working group. As Avery pointed out, there is also another cross-community working group already working on this, but it has a broader scope on human rights. So our task or our focus should be to specifically target the questions that were raised on Workstream 1 in regard to human rights. So that would be my first impressions on human rights. And since we've already tackled an easy one, let's jump to the other easy discussion, jurisdiction. Okay, so the floor is now open for thoughts and ideas on jurisdiction. And I see Cavus.
No, on that, sorry, excuse me, just one point. Too many emphasis was given to the external advisor. The group that you were led was open to everybody. We had sufficient individual expert on human rights, and the group was open. Anyone could come. We don't need to make a specific invitation to somebody come up from the sky and saying, I am the advisor of the human rights, what I should say, please follow. He is welcome, she is welcome, they can come and contribute like others without any specific privilege that I am advisor, listen to me. So let us exclude that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. That is important. And as Thomas said earlier, we will be calling for volunteers at some point to form this group. So I think that everyone will be actually welcome to join any of the groups. So we'll keep this as open and as inclusive and transparent as we have conducted the rest of the work in this working group. So now the floor is open for thoughts on jurisdiction. And I see two hands up that I'm not sure if those are old hands or new hands. I see Erica and I see Alan. So could you just please?
Yeah, it's a new hand.
Okay, so Erica.
You want me? Okay. It actually fits to both topics, so the human rights topic and to the jurisdiction. And it was a reference to what Cavus just said. I think, Cavus, I'm not saying that we need to invite outside expert on the human rights field forever. But you need sometimes expertise which is really looking into a specific topic which is so controversial and which is so actual and currently debated in the legal environment, and which is so, can be so challenging for our particular system, that it is sometimes important because we will not automatically have the knowledge available. We do have a lot of knowledge, and I agree with you, but you need sometimes somebody coming in because it is so, so new and so fresh, how it is a topic is reviewed, that we will need this. So I'm, in principle, I agree with you. We have enough knowledge in our environment. But there will be occasions, and this would be my, when we talk about the jurisdiction as well, this will be my plea that whenever it is needed, we don't need to have a constant team of legal advisors talking to us all the time. But sometimes there will be a particular topic which is so conflictual, and this is in jurisdiction as well, when you talk about international law and local laws and how they clash and how you, and in particular in our environment, where we will need sometimes some kind of advice. And I would urge us not to overlook this, Caboose. I hope it's understood.
Thank you very much, Erica. I think it's very clear now. So next on the queue, I have Alan Greenberg.
Thank you. I'm going to make a comment that some people may consider lighthearted or not. I suggest we defer this topic for 9 months until we find out who the incoming U.S. president is. It may change some people's perspective.
Well, that is a factor to consider, actually. Matthew?
Thank you, Alan. I don't know what you're referring to. That's totally alien to me. what I want to remind all of us, and I think that's worth doing it on each of the topics, is the amount of discussion we've already had on jurisdiction as part of Workstream 1. That work was pretty much focused in the first months of Workstream 1. We haven't touched a lot this part of our report since the first public comment, actually. But we have actually already tried to outline the multifaceted approach of jurisdiction and identified a sort of a preferred way forward, or at least one facet we thought would be valuable in investigating. And I would encourage us not to reopen everything, but stay focused on that facet, which was the contractual, the jurisdiction of the contracts, mostly, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that's something that we'll need to, that would be useful for when we come to Workstream 2, is not to reinvent our own wheel. We can reinvent other wheels if we want to, but maybe not our own. And so that's the one point, the first point. Second point, and that's part of the call we've had with our independent lawyers before we come into Marrakesh a few days ago, and the notes have been circulated to the full list now. The lawyers specifically pointed at this particular item as one where some legal input in terms of terminology and general concepts might be useful to avoid people talking past each other in the course of the work, and that's very much echoing what Erica was saying earlier. So I think those are the two points that I wanted to put on the record for that Workstream 2 item. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Next in the queue, I have Samantha Eisner.
Hi, this is Samantha Eisner from ICANN staff. On jurisdiction, I think that there are others on the list that could also fall into this, but this is one where there's a clear experiential base within ICANN and ICANN staff that deals with the operations of how this works, and I think that that's a really important input to be taken into account. We have a group within ICANN that works on globalization efforts that have actually, in the past couple years, have innovated some of our contracts to allow for different jurisdictions to be taken into account. And so these are the kinds of, it's not just about going outside of ICANN and asking what you can do, but I think it's really important to get the inputs on how ICANN operations impact and what they've already done, what they've looked at, what they consider in terms of this, and take that as another input and potentially work collaboratively with them so that we don't run into a place where we have recommendations that might not be legally feasible for the organization. I think there's a good path to collaboration here.
Thank you very much, Sam. And I think that kind of complements what Matthew was highlighting. There is there are more topics into jurisdiction than just where ICANN is based. So I think that the work that this group within ICANN staff has done should be a very valuable asset for this working group, should be definitely taken into account. I think it could be a very good starting point to flesh out more details about jurisdiction. So next on the queue, I have Siva.
Leon, your observations just now helps me explain my point more easily. I was going to propose that the topic of jurisdiction could even be renamed as justice or global justice or a judicial framework, because ICANN could act in a fair and just manner even without a change of jurisdiction. And then when we talk about jurisdiction, we tend to have an approach related to which lawyer we engage and which court of law we go to, whereas if we rename the topic and look at the topic a little more broadly, a lot more aspects could be covered, and the topic could proceed less controversially. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Siva. I wouldn't jump into renaming the issue at this point. I would rather defer it for the group that will be taking care of the issue to actually decide whether we should rename it or not. For the moment, I would like to remain consistent with what our report states, so I would keep away from renaming any of the issues at this point, but that's definitely also a constructive view, Siva. Thank you very much. Next on the queue, I have Steve Del Bianco.
Thanks, Leon. On this particular one, jurisdiction, it strikes me that it is more descriptive than normative. The task of this work stream is to understand the jurisdictional aspects of not just ICANN per se, but contracted parties, registrars, registrants, end users, and so on, because that is the confusion that has caused us so many times to ask, what does applicable law mean? And we've deferred it to Workstream 2 since it wasn't essential to resolve these questions in Workstream 1. And I am as eager as anyone to understand the jurisdiction. In particular, there was an RCEP for XYZ.com that got into this whole notion of jurisdiction. And I want to know more. In the business constituency, where we submitted comments on that really just asked questions. So because this is more descriptive than normative, right, it takes some of the pressure off at trying to come up with recommendations to change things. So I don't really, I enjoyed the humor about wondering who the next U.S. president is, but like Aubrey, I don't think that's relevant to the question of descriptively where you're doing business, where you're incorporated, where your registrar is based, and where ICANN is based. How do those all factor in to the question of what is the applicable law that applies to the conduct and content on the web? Not a lot of which has much to do with ICANN, frankly, but it would be useful for us to discover that.
Thank you very much, Steve. Next on the queue, I have Pedro. Pedro da Silva.
Yes, thank you, Leon. This is Pedro from the Brazilian government. I think during the short period that we have discussed the issue of jurisdiction, and as Mathieu reminded us, it was right at the beginning of our work, I think we have made quite some progress. We actually all agree that this is not a simple issue. It's quite a complex. It entails many aspects. And we even came to making a list of initial list of items that this concept would entail. But and if you allow me, Mathieu, to a little bit disagree with you, but I think we should, since this list was made, let's say, as an informal brainstorming and let's say, long time ago, I think we should revisit that list. And as an initial task of this working group is to redo that brainstorming, and based on the, let's say, the experience we have had throughout this last year and all the months we have worked, and I think reassess all the items that we have indicated here, probably adding new ones. I think, for example, during the discussion on human rights, also some issues related to jurisdiction also came into the discussion. So I think as a first task of the working group, we should definitely revisit the concept and really list again what are all the aspects related to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pedro. And yes, as you highlight, some definitions are missing in this exercise. Just as Steve was also pointing out, we need to understand what does applicable law mean, and that is something that feeds also into the human rights discussion. So I see already some linkage between the work from one group to the another. So that is something that we should also factor in when designing the groups and, of course, carrying out the work of each of the groups. Next on the queue, I have Sebastian Bachelet.
Yes, thank you, Leon. Sebastian Bachelet speaking. Just as you take note here about this topic, to repeat what I say earlier this morning, there was a President Strategy Committee who worked on that issue long time ago, but it may be useful to take those documents to this working group. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just to be clear, it was a poll to me, President Strategy Committee, on this question.
Okay.
It may also be helpful in that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. Caboose?
Yes, jurisdiction is an extremely complex issue. First of all, I think it might be good that we do not talk about the elections in our group here. That this is something outside our mandate, and we should not talk about that discussions on the jurisdiction depends on the result of elections. That means we prejudging or we entering in something which is not our duty at all. So I suggest that if possible, we should not mention that. It was said, very good, we heard, but I think that it doesn't mean reflect the views of anybody here. So it is not good to talk about that. And I don't think that election of individual would have impact on the legal issues in the world. Jurisdiction is legal issues. I don't think that X and Y would change that. Outside experts is good, provided that would not dominate and would not put anything as a status that what I'm saying is this. So we are prepared to listen to that if the area is so difficult that we don't have. But I don't see any major output out of that. Applicable law, 125 mails have been exchanged, and there is no agreement what is applicable law. So extremely difficult, but please kindly be aware of that. It may not come to some sort of results that you expect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavos. Anyone else wants to share their thoughts or ideas on this topic? Okay, I see no one else raising their hand. So just to recap a little bit on what we have heard, we should have outside expertise available and ready to provide any advice or any knowledge in a neutral and objective way outside ICANN. We also have to take advantage of the work that the ICANN staff has done already in the globalization working team. That should also be taken into account because it could be a very valuable asset for this discussion. We should be mindful that this is a more descriptive than normative discussion, and we need to find out a way to define what applicable law means in the remit of ICANN's operations and in the remit of this sub-working group. We might be needing to revisit the concept of jurisdiction, about what does jurisdiction mean, how we focus the discussion on the different impacts that jurisdiction might have on the different areas within ICANN. And, of course, we should have a look at the work that Sebastian was mentioning about this committee that worked on this issue years ago. We might have also valuable input there that someone else has already done, so it should be taken into account. So to continue our discussion, we have tackled two of the issues, and I would like to continue with the next topic, SO and AC accountability. And I see Erika's and Siva's hand are up, but I'm not sure if those are all hands or new hands. Erika, is that a new hand or an old hand?
It's an old hand.
It's an old
but
hand.
But I have something else which I was sent by email. There's something which was written here, not really responding to what we said. But I do this by email.
Okay, thank you, Erika. Siva is not here, so I assume that is an old hand. And I see Olga Cavalli hand is up. Olga?
Hello, this is Olga Cavalli for the record. Thank you, Leon. My comment was going to be the addressed for diversity, but I think it's relevant for SO and AC accountability. I think that part of the things that should be revised in relation with the structure of the SOs and AC is related with accountability. There is no accountability if it's not related with diversity. If, as far as I've been participating in ICANN for more than 10 years, I don't see part of the broad internet community reflected in the ICANN structure today. I don't see small and medium enterprises of Latin America, which are essential part of our economy, reflected in the business constituency. And although I see the gap growing, we still need relevant participation. So there is a lot of to do within the SOs and AC to improve diversity, and that will bring more accountability to these groups. We have learned some lessons in the past. I think that we can learn from them. New GTLDs was a good example that if you do some events, it's not enough to bring the broad, diverse community to the what happens in ICANN. So I think this discussion is really linked with diversity. We have done some efforts. There are some documents that I was involved in my times of the GNSO. So I would like to work in this aspect and also in the diversity group. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Olga, for highlighting the importance of the linkage between accountability and diversity. I have a queue that goes for people in the AC room and outside the AC room. So I have Alan, Jan, Thomas, Everhard, and Avery. So, Alan, could you please?
Thank you very much. A very brief intervention. I think this is another one that we need to have a common understanding or at least a common statement of what we mean by it so others can critique it. The concept of accountability, if it's accountability to the people who are in the room, it's one thing. If it's accountability to the wider group, some of whom who don't know ICANN exists, it's a completely different thing. And I think we need to understand what we're trying to fix by making sure the ACs and SOs are accountable before we try to fix them. We're talking about some very, very different constructs and different situations, and we really have to have a common idea of what we're trying to fix, or we're going to go off with multiple directions with things that don't necessarily make sense. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Mathieu?
Yeah, just a reminder that I think we've discussed this
question a few times already, every time we've discussed SOAC accountability, and it's our approach has been constantly that it's about SOAC accountability to the broader set of stakeholders that each SOAC is designed to represent. I think that's the wording we've used. So it's definitely the broader approach from in your options. Yeah. So how is the CCNSO accountable to all CCTLD managers, for instance? Just to use the easiest approach, but trust me, from a CCNSO perspective, it's not that easy. But that's the approach.
Alan, do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, just a very quick one. You're right. We have said that, but every time we actually have the discussion, many of the people who are intervening are talking about a different accountability. That's why I said we have to come to an agreement, not just say the words.
Thank you, Alan. Next on the queue, I have John Schulte.
Yeah, thanks, John Schulte. Just that we have already done a lot of work in Frankfurt and afterwards and in the proposal on a framework of analysis for accountability. And I think we can take that and apply it to the question of SOAC accountability. And I think then we basically have a conceptual framework. We've largely done the work. We don't need to redo it.
Thank you, John. That's also true and very important. Next is Thomas.
Yes, thanks, Leon. What I'd like to understand, and maybe you guys are all clear about this and it's just me, is the plan in this group to come up with general principles applicable to all SOACs on how they should improve their accountability to their respective stakeholders, or are you actually reviewing SOAC accountability one by one, coming up with specific recommendations on, let's say, Steve and his BC should not raise membership fees to $500,000, excluding everyone but the richest companies in the world to be able to participate. Likewise, we've heard requests for more transparency in the GACS operations, right? So is the group's intention to come up with a list of recommendations for individual groups, or are we discussing general principles of accountability for all SOACs? I think that's at least for me an unanswered question so far.
Thank you, Thomas. And if I may comment on that, I think that the scope of our work in that subgroup should be focused on designing general principles for the different SOs and ACs rather than digging into each of the SOs and ACs. We have a system for SOs and ACs to establish their own governance rules, etc. So we don't want to go into each of the SOs and ACs particularly, but rather design general principles that all SOs and ACs should abide to in their respective ambience or environments to be held accountable and transparent to the different constituencies and SOs and ACs. So I think the short answer is general principles. Next in the queue, I have Eberhard.
Eberhard Disser, .NA. I'm very grateful for the remarks of the GAC representative for Argentina to include the GAC in increasing its accountability.
Thank you very much, Eberhard. Next on the queue, I have Avery.
Thank you. Avery speaking. I think it's interesting the last couple comments made sort of anticipated where I was going to go in my comment. I think that we have a real issue here in terms of even understanding what we're talking about when we're talking about the SOAC, because it's easy, as Alan said, for example, to say, are we talking about the general or are we talking about the specific accountability of a particular SO or AC? And we're able to say, sure, we're talking about accountability in the world, but we're only looking at it through the microcosm of CCTLDs when it's CCNSO or GTLDs. So basically, we don't have a one group that represents all people. And so it is global, but it always has to be specific to the kind of orientation. I think the larger question goes up, if there's some group that we are not including in one of our SOs or ACs, then how are we dealing with that? So that particular question is complex in that you have to deal with both the foreground and the background. Is it global or is it specific? I think, and this comes out partly from what Eberhard has said, we've had various conversations about is group X accountable enough, or group Y doesn't have, you know, sufficient accountability measures, and we had within certainly, you know, NCSG a certain concern about GAC accountability. But when looking at that, and this is why I don't think we should get into the specifics too much, but we also have to realize that each of the groups is essentially so very different, so that the notion of accountability within that group, but still situated within the global, is confusing and is complicated. So I think that even before we get to a framework, we really have to get to an understanding of what we mean by SOAC or ACSO accountability and how we parse those differences and the foreground-background discussions.
Thank you very much, Avery. Next on the queue, I have Cavus.
Yes, I was typing here that if, as Matthew said, we establish a principle to make a given SO and AC accountable to a larger group, if it is not implementable, it is useless. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. Next on the queue, I have Sebastian. Sebastian Bachelet.
Thank you. Sebastian Bachelet. Yes, just to add one point, I think that each group needs to be accountable to their population or member or participant, whatever. And we need also to find a way to have accountability between ASO and ACs, and that may be one part of the work of this working group. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. And I think that has been discussed and reflected in the mutual accountability roundtable that at some point we discussed within the working party. So I guess that's an idea that will need to be further developed and fleshed out throughout the work of this subgroup. Next on the queue, I have Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. Sebastian just mentioned members, and Thomas made reference to the fees someone may charge to join. I think we have to keep in mind, and this may not apply across the board, there's a very different issue about who you are accountable to or who you should be accountable to if they had a mechanism to make you accountable versus your members. At large, for instance, claims we are representing the interest of end users, all end users, 4 billion or whatever the number is today. The number of people who are members of at large or the groups are those with an interest in ICANN. I have news for you. Most end users don't have an interest in ICANN. And if we do our job right, that will stay that way. So who you are representing, who you should be accountable to for doing your job right, not necessarily the members who have to pay your fees or join. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Next on the queue, I have Brett Schaffer.
Thank you. I'm a bit confused. I thought we were talking about diversity, but we seem to have merged the two topics.
Okay,
I'll wait on my comment then.
Thanks, Brett. I'm closing the queue with Chris Despain. I have Steve DelBianco and then Chris Despain. So the queue is now closed. Steve?
Thank you. I wanted to remind you all, and I put this in the chat, in our Workstream 1 recommendations, the ones we published, Annex 10 is on SOAC accountability. We already have a recommendation for Workstream 1 in the bylaws drafting to say that in the review of SO and AC accountability mechanisms in the independent periodic structural reviews, because as you know, ICANN does periodic structural reviews of the AC and SOs themselves, other than the GAC. And we said, quote, these reviews should include consideration of the mechanisms that each SO and AC has in place to be accountable to their respective constituencies, stakeholder groups, regional at-large organizations, et cetera. Matthew, you made this point earlier in clarifying the answer, to whom is it accountable? So we have approved that. And so we are expecting our lawyers to come back with a small bylaws change to the section of the bylaws on reviews of ACs and SOs. So that is a phase one item. One of the reasons it's phase one is our stress tests, in fact, they were suggested by NTIA after our first draft in May. And NTIA asked about accountability, and we are relying upon this improvement in the structural reviews to be sure that there are mechanisms in place that would allow something like BC membership to challenge this idea of raising dues to an exorbitant level and excluding people who couldn't afford it. So some of this is in Workstream 1. I realize Workstream 2 is described in Annex 10, but Workstream 1 takes a bite out of this issue for us.
Thank you very much, Steve. And Chris has lowered his hand. So to do a very quick recap, some of the points that we heard here and that are captured, of course, in the notes are the link between accountability and diversity, which Olga raised, the need for a common statement or a common understanding on what do we mean about or in regard to SO and AC accountability. We already have a lot of work done as part of our Workstream 1 efforts, and that should definitely feed the work of this subgroup and should definitely be taken into account, as John pointed. And we would be looking for defining general principles as opposed to reviewing particular issues of each SO and AC. We need to refine the focus on whether this work or this accountability should be something global or specific. And the idea of the mutual accountability roundtable is still on the table, so we should definitely revisit that idea and see how accountability from different SOs and ACs to each other relates and flesh it out. So with that, I would close this item, and I would turn to my co-chair Mathieu for the next issue.
Thank you very much, Leon, and indeed you served well with some very interesting issues already. So the next on the list is diversity. Diversity is a word we've been using a lot in our discussions and discussing a lot in the course of our Workstream 1 efforts. Just as a reminder, we had formal contribution by our external advisors that there was a strong linkage between the diversity of stakeholders involved in the ICANN processes and the ability for ICANN to make decisions that are consistent with the global public interest. It was better worded than that in the report, but I think that was really the core fact that made it one of the key issues for Workstream 2. And so I think we also need to recognize that there are multiple dimensions to diversity, multiple views, and also that diversity discussions are very, very widely documented in corporate governance, political science, everything, sociology, everywhere. There's certainly a lot to take from existing experience into increasing diversity into a specific organizational culture. But having said that, which was really what we had in Workstream 1, let's start the exchange of ideas. And I would like to turn to Brett, because you said you were deferring your comment until we come to diversity. So maybe you want to take the floor first, and then I'll go to the queue.
Thank you. My comment is not about the subject matter, but what actually underlies it, which is a question: do we have statistics on the diversity of ICANN in the SO and ACs and in the general discussions currently? And then do we have statistics going backwards so we can see trends over time? I think that kind of information would inform the discussion and find out exactly what the areas lacking might be. whether there's been improvements over time, and so whether this just needs a nudge in the right direction or whether this is something more serious than that. And I think metrics on this issue would be helpful in trying to inform the discussion, and that's basically my comment.
So I'm not going to answer your question, but I think it's a really good idea to start with the actual data for such a discussion. Thank you very much, Brett. Erika, is that a new hand? No? Okay, so Sebastian is next.
Yes, thank you, Sebastian Bachelet. I totally agree with Brett, and I would like to extend that to not just ASO and AC, but to all the ICANN bodies. We need to have those metrics. There are plenty of others, not just ASO and ACs, or not just at the level of ASO and ACs. We need to do that. I think it's very important. And I just want, you say it, Mathieu, but we have a document on the 24th of July 2015 about diversity, who could be a very good document to start with, because we had a subgroup working on that, and it could be the document to start the work on this working group. Thank you.
How could I ever forget the Work Party 3 document on diversity, chaired by my fellow co-chair, Leon, with your contribution, Sebastian. Next is Paul.
Thank you, Matthew. I raised diversity as an issue in one of our public meetings last year, and I've thought about it very carefully. I wonder if I could make a couple of quite pointed comments, and they're pointed in this sense, that I just wanted to focus on one aspect of diversity, and to take a quite hard-nosed realpolitik view of ICANN's future, which I think is important. It's always been my personal analysis of ICANN since 1999 that the only two groups within its broad range of constituencies who have the power to destroy ICANN, or who at a minimum have the power to change the global nature of its functions or limit the global nature of its functions, are the technical and network operating groups, the actual geeks, or its governments. And I think the chances of what we're doing here and the ICG work, et cetera, and the involvement of the various constituencies limits and keeps engaged the technical and geek part of the world. But I think we should be clear that since 1999, the environment around governments has changed significantly. If you think about the formation of ICANN, it was formed at the peak of Western influence in the 1990s, and not only the peak of Western influence, but the peak of Wilsonian thinking in American influence. So American policy has over time varied between realpolitik through to Wilsonian ideals. So the global ideals of the technology community and the global ideas, Wilsonian reflection of universalist values in the Americans, all came together in 1990s when ICANN was formed. And so if you look at the way in which we think about who attends, the values we've put forward, it's a globalized, meritocratic, bottom-up architecture that we talk about. But we are now in a different world. We should be quite clear about that. And Kavuz, please forgive me. I am going to mention specific countries in a general sense. But, you know, we are definitely in a time when the U.S., there's a debate about overreach. We're at a time when China, which has generally adhered to Westphalian state principles during its rise, is now clearly indicating in broad senses that it's willing to rewrite the rule books on various things. Europe's got a hybrid. Russia, which sees itself as the essential state and culture in Eurasia, is also showing strength. Middle East is changing. The point I'm trying to make is we're not in the same world order. Which brings me to the statistics people asked about, because it strikes me we do have to look at the issues, not only of our own culture and bottom-up, but from the outside perspective, do we continue to maintain legitimacy? So to give you some specific numbers people have asked about, I've done the numbers on board participation in ICANN. Brett, at least I've got those statistics. And if you look at the board representation in ICANN until last year, 32% of the years of board years are held by Americans. 27% is held by Europe. less than 1% by China. The rest of Asia Pacific is 17%, of which Australia takes up a fair amount. India, it's 4%. Russia, it's 0%. Africa and Latin America together is 19%. But if you then turn around and say who the majority uses the internet today, it is China. Then we've got, I think I've made my point. So it's a, this for us is going to be a very difficult issue, because I think it says that our method of bottom-up participatory election processes, which I think are incredibly important, we do have to think about what do we have to do or where are we failing to not at least have some better reflection of the world as it is today as opposed to the world it was in the 1990s.
Thanks, Paul. That's I think that's an excellent point. I'm going to close the queue after Cavus on these items because I'm conscious of time and I want us to still have time for the last remaining two items, although it might be a little shorter. Next in the queue is Tijani.
Thank you, Mathieu. Paul just spoke about one aspect of diversity, which is regional diversity. And you are right to include the multiple dimension of the diversity. We need to have all other diversities that are well documented in the document that Sebastian spoke about. But even for the regional diversity, I think that things have to change. Because if you give people the choice between the country where they are where they are living and their original country, you may end up having people from the same spirit and with the same interests. Because for sure, I may be born in Tunisia, but living all my life in France. So I will not have the interest of Tunisian people in mind. So I think things have to change in this regard, and we have to be clear about what is the regional diversity. It is not if you have roots anywhere, you are coming from this region. Thank you.
Thank you, Tijani. Next is Malcolm. I think what's really valuable here, if we highlight new items that need to be considered in the reflections, and let's not reinstate the points that have been made already. Please, Malcolm.
This is not a point that has already made already, Mathieu. Thank you for the floor. I can, to a large extent, and like the rest of the ISTAR organisations, has always sought to be operated according to be, to a very large extent, taken pride in being and succeeded from being a largely meritocratic organisation. And by meritocratic, I mean where people bring their ideas and propositions and demands to it, and they're evaluated by those that do the evaluation on the basis of the content of what they say and not on the basis of who is saying it. I think it is extremely important that this is preserved. It is only works and only successful and only can create real legitimacy if the people that are there and that are willing to come to raise those issues really reflect all the people that are impacted by the decisions that are brought forward or the issues that are brought forward and the decisions that are made. If it is a small and closed group, and if those who have legitimate interest in the matters under discussions either unable to or feel that they are unable to come and take part fully, then that significantly undermines the legitimacy and effectiveness of what is being decided. So it is very important that outreach mechanisms and things like travel support plans and things are looked at and extended so as to ensure that the community can really affect those that were impacted by the decisions that the community takes collectively. However, Mathieu, you spoke about a range of political and sociological views on this, and I think we are all aware that there is a big strand in diversity science. No, science is the wrong word. Diversity theory. That seeks to construct privileged sociological groups that determines whether or not ideas are given weight according to who is speaking and not according, and their characteristics, and not according to the content of the idea itself. That instead divides us into tribes. In my view, these things can verge at its extreme on out-and-out racism. There should be no place in ICANN for this. So we need to be very wary as we look at the diversity issue of ensuring that we improve and build upon and reinforce the ability of this community to give full voice to all those that are affected by and wish to participate in and encourage the support of those that are impacted by this community's work, and do not revert into essentially warring tribes where we count the value of what is said according to some status in a hierarchy of sociological groupings. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malcolm, because you're framing exactly the kind of difference of views that exist about how to approach diversity in corporate governance, political elections, whatever you want. And that's exactly the kind of discussion we need to have in this diversity group. I'm not going to step into that right now, but I think from the looks I'm seeing in the room, it's obvious we'll have some discussions on that. And that's very, very welcome. Next is Olga. I think I had closed after Caruso, but Olga.
Thank you, Matthew. This is Olga Cavalli for the record. I would like to support what Paul Toomey said, and I welcome the statistics. I would encourage also to add one other dimension, which is the gender diversity. It is clear that all the ISTAR organizations need more gender diversity, especially in their leadership positions. So I would encourage to add that dimension to it. And I also would like to support what Tijani said about define where people come from and where they live. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Olga. Caruso?
Yes, Matthew. Once again, variety of issues. Expertise, knowledge, qualification diversity, cultural diversity, linguistic diversity, sexual diversity, ability versus disability diversity, age diversity, social diversity, and so on and so forth. You can write a book, you can write 5 pages. Unless you have criteria to implement that, it would remain words in the book. Not implementable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caruso, for this good, excellent reminder. And last but not least, Siva, and then we'll break for coffee.
Thank you. Diversity is very important, but at the same time, the topic has to be approached in such a manner that it's not politicized. Otherwise, we'll end up with 210 board members and have a subcommittee for developing South and board and so on. So I suggest that we approach it very carefully. I recall that Olivier Crepin LeBlond at large would say that at large works in the best interest of internet users. He would not say at large represents the interests of internet users. And so extending that, if we have a structure whereby we can say that ICANN acts in the best interest of the global internet user and global internet community, that should be good enough, rather than have gender diversity, geographic diversity, and every country represents having a seat in ICANN and so on. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Siva. I think that highlights very much what the size of the issue is going to be on this item. Certainly a very interesting one to follow. Encourage everyone to participate. But for now on, being conscious of time, I think we can have a well-deserved coffee break. We will resume with these three other items and try to narrow a little bit the amount of time we can dedicate to them at this point, so that we can end up roughly on time. But we can just definitely take 15 minutes break and reconvene at 25 past. Thank you very much. Okay. Let us resume our meeting. We took a little bit more time on the previous agenda item, so we still have three Workstream 2 items to shortly discuss, and I'm very aware of the timing of the meeting and don't want to delay you too much, and certainly not to the point where the sun would be setting and you would not be able to enjoy it anymore. So the next item is the staff accountability item. We had a few discussions in Work Party 3 about the potential code of conduct approach that could be developed around this. And I think it was pretty well framed. You will note in the document a comment by Sam Eisner, and as staff liaison, obviously her input is very valuable to this particular item, that we need to be careful about not interfering with the employer-employee relationship in this kind of matter. I just like to keep it at this. We would need to add a point about code of conduct, which was one of the approaches that was discussed earlier to the list of items here on the document. And I'd like to now turn to other short, concise contributions that need to be taken into account when discussing this item, if there are any. There doesn't seem to be any, which proves that this is right to the point and that our framing has been excellent. So I think we shouldn't dwell on this too much at this point. It doesn't really create any issue. The next item is transparency, and transparency has several dimensions that are already outlined in our recommendation number 12. There is DIDP, document information disclosure. There's transparency of board deliberations. There is transparency of interactions with governments. I'm missing, I think, at least one of them, but certainly the room will remind me. I think we've already had a number of significant discussions on this, but if anyone wants to add a clarifications or things that would be out of the scope for this group, that's also very useful because it helps us focus. But to me, we've had already extensive discussions about transparency and how this is a key aspect of accountability in many ways. Robin.
Sorry, I was trying to raise my hand online, but it wasn't seeming to register. I just wanted to add that we had talked about creating a culture of transparency throughout all of ICANN's operations and the way it does business. So that was something else to put on the list. Thanks.
Thank you, Robin. Janard?
Just maybe an issue of effective transparency. It's one thing to disclose documents. It's another thing to make them readable.
Thanks, Jan. Okay, so once again, I think we've framed that discussion quite well in our past work, so it shouldn't be too much of an issue. But Malcolm?
I mean, this may come under cultural transparency, but something I think the principle of transparency, meaning that things should be open unless there's a good reason not to be, as opposed to the other way around.
Thank you. That's indeed been something we've discussed a number of times. And finally, the AC room's not working anymore, but Ed?
Thanks, guys. Ed Marsh for the record. I don't know how to phrase this. One of the things that interests me and that we should probably take a look at our board. I love my board members. And they would never do anything unethical. I know that. But there are board members in the year 2025 I'm not too sure about. And external speaking fees, speaking before trade associations, the income received from that, is there some way we could talk about and take a look at how other corporations deal with this, but seeing whether that should be something they should have to disclose under the guise of transparency?
Thanks, Ed. I had Jonathan, and then Alan, and then Avery, and then we'll probably wrap this up. Jonathan.
Matthew, I know you want to wrap this up, and at the risk of sounding redundant, on this notion of effective transparency, I think the only way that you can define that is by outlining the goals for transparency. And I think sometimes we make the mistake of treating transparency as an end goal when it's not. It's a means to an end, which is sometimes accountability or something else. And operational accountability is partly what will help define whether or not you have effective transparency. So transparency without context is a useless term. And I think defining the objectives for it and measuring the success of those objectives is how we'll determine whether we have the good transparency.
Thanks. Very very useful indeed to have to map the different mechanisms with their respective goals. Alan?
Thank you. The question was asked earlier, do we want to merge any of these items? And I and others said no. But I will point out this one and the previous one are closely linked. A lot of issues of lack of accountability of staff are because they can do it invisibly, and the two are heavily linked. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a point to keep in mind, indeed. Avery?
Thanks, Avery speaking. One of the things I wanted to mention, and it's a point related to many of these, is that in the previous two ATRT outcomes documents, there were lots of recommendations made. So I think one of the things, especially this group more than many of the others, is to make sure to go back and hit those and compare them and such. Thanks.
Yeah, some background work really needed on this because there's a lot of documentation already. Excellent point, Avery. I have Cavus and then Brett. Cavus.
Sorry, Matthew, when you deal with staff accountability, I missed one point. I don't know, unless this relationship coming from the report, I don't think that we should talk about relationship. We should talk about hierarchy, but not relationship. We don't enter into the business of relation between the staff, employee, employer. We are talking of hierarchy. Any accountability should not impact the hierarchy between the employee and employer. So we should not want to destroy that order that employee should be treated under the hierarchy in response to the responsibility they have. We don't want to undermine the duties of the hierarchies people with respect to their staff. So perhaps instead of relationship in the first bullet, you said hierarchy, but not relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. And certainly, there must be a proper legal wording for that aspect in English that I'm not familiar with anyway. Brett, and then we'll go to the next item, please.
Thank you. This has a bit to do with both staff accountability and transparency. But I would like to make sure that the issue of ICANN's conflict of interest policy is examined or re-examined in one of these two areas. I was talking with someone earlier, and apparently there's a question about how that conduct of or conflict of interest policy is actually interpreted, and there is apparently some ambiguity there, and I don't think that it's good to have ambiguity on that matter. So if there is indeed ambiguity over conflict of interest policy, who is covered, under what circumstances you have to report a conflict of interest if you're a covered person, I think that that needs to be resolved and clarified. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. So I think what we can conclude and take stock of regarding transparency is that there are many dimensions
I think the point raised by Jonathan about linking these dimensions to a specific accountability goal is going to be extremely useful if we want to prioritize but also explain the purpose of what we are introducing. And that was a valuable discussion. Last item on our list is the Ombudsman. We have identified a number of potential improvements, discussed this already a little bit earlier today. Just like for other items, if there are any substantial inputs about how to frame this discussion, I'm seeing Siva's hand up to initiate the discussion. Siva?
My suggestion is that not only the independence of the Ombudsman should be enhanced, but his stature also needs to be enhanced. Ombudsman must be plenipotentiary, no pun intended in using this term, that he does not have to depend on the pleasure or displeasure of anybody in ICANN, and he has to decide whether to accept a case or not accept a case, and not accept only those cases that are pre-screened. And that there are several barriers that are associated with the office of the Ombudsman. Everything must go, and the stature of the Ombudsman must be enhanced to a sufficient level so that he is fully empowered. And if there is a need to make any provision to remove the Ombudsman, the removal process of the Ombudsman should exceed the thresholds that are specified for removal of a board member. Thank you.
Thank you, Siva. Important points. Avery.
And Chris.
Thank you. Avery speaking. I think one of the issues that we have to discuss in terms of the Ombudsman is, at the moment, the role is very limited to sort of a mediation, giving advice, giving comment, but really has no... There's no issue on which the Ombudsman is a decider. Now, some of the discussions we had across the year had the possibility of using an Ombudsman's decision as a gating mechanism for some further process. And that would be a deviation from that, probably a good deviation, I'm not judging it, but really there's, in that role, are they purely, is it purely a suggestive mechanism, mediative mechanism, or are there any points at which an Ombudsman actually has some decision-making capability? And not trying to prejudice that discussion, just I think it's one we need to have.
And you're right to point this out. It's been a constant question being raised and raised and discussed again on our list every time we've discussed the Ombudsman. Ed, and then it's going to be Chris. Ed.
Okay, thanks, guys. I think some of the earlier comments can be dealt with by saying we need to look at the hiring, firing, and retention of the Ombudsman. Who does it? Right now, it's the board, and he's responsible to the board. That can't go on in our new statement. The question is who should do it. Number two, the access of employees to the Ombudsman. Currently at ICANN, employees cannot take problems to the Ombudsman. I think that should change, or something we should look at. The criteria the Ombudsman can use to render decisions. We've had a discussion on list about this, but fairness tends to be the number one criteria. Should that be expanded? Should he be able to evaluate on other criteria? And then if so, do we in this community want an Ombudsman, or are we looking at something more like an inspector general or some other unique classification? Because some of the things that folks have proposed for the Ombudsman to do generally are not within the remit of a classical Ombudsman. So I think we should take a look as to whether an Ombudsman suits what we want best or whether some other classification could work better. Thanks.
Thanks, Ed. And Chris is next.
Thank you. Chris Lahat for the record. This isn't the time for me to tell you about the model of an Ombudsman under the International Ombudsman Association principles. But if you come to my session later on in the week, I can tell you about that in more detail. One of the purposes of that session is to do the sort of information gathering rather than necessarily the recommendations out of it. I want to get ideas about what people want. But I think the real purpose for me speaking now is to adopt what Eberhard said, that the discussion about the ombudsman role should come at the end of this process. The ombudsman has a role in virtually all of the previous topics. So once you decide on the sort of issues for accountability in those previous topics, things like diversity, things like human rights, you'll have to think, well, should this be something we send to the ombudsman? Is this an area where the ombudsman should have a specific mention as the mechanism for exploring problems which have arisen? I already have specific jurisdiction on diversity, for example, and to some extent human rights as well, to the limited extent that they've been raised in my office. And things like transparency, the document disclosure policy. I've been very surprised that people haven't utilised my office to try and get access to documents, because if you look at my bylaw, it says I've got access to everything. Now, how often when you're trying to dig through the DITP policy have people thought, well, let's ask the ombudsman to have a look at that? That might be my fault for not explaining that sufficiently well to people, but there are powers which are there. And so, therefore, my session will hopefully consider some of these issues and just start thinking on what I can actually do. But I can tell you now that decision-making is unlikely to be something that would make my office an ombudsman office. If you want to get somebody to make decisions, then it's not going to be called an ombudsman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. That's extremely useful. And I mean, what I'm taking from this discussion is we need to be clear on the requirements first before thinking about the tool, whether it's an ombudsman or an inspector general or any other tool. The one thing we need to be clear about, and that's going to be true for every Workstream 2 item, is what are our requirements? What are we trying to achieve and why? We have, I've raised that an old hand or a new hand? Old hand. And so, Cavus, Siva, and then we'll move to our next agenda item. Cavus.
Yes, I am checking something. First of all, bullet 2 is not clear. Removal process threshold for ombudsman should exceed threshold for removal of the board members. Are you talking of the recall of the entire board or what? What means exceeds? Should not exceed.
I think at this point we should probably be less specific about this in this document. It's about should there be a removal process for the ombudsman.
So maybe put it in that way, because you are just putting explicit. And
we,
then the
we haven't
one
agreed
have,
on that.
Yeah, difficulty. What is the fourth one? Is it from the proposal of the CCWG that the no longer ombudsman report to the board and no longer appointed by him, or is it something we want to study?
It was a point raised in the discussion, and one of the questions that was raised was the independence of the ombudsman and how it can be placed in the structure. I think, once again, we need to reframe this sentence in a more generic way, because it's in no way have we agreed on this at this point.
There
it's
are problems
issues
before.
To consider.
Before I have problems. Yeah, thank
I
you.
Agree, and we'll rephrase this. Next is Siva.
Ombudsman said that decision-making is unlikely to be within his purview, but does he strike a distinction between a decision and a ruling? An ombudsman is supposed to make a ruling, and if he is to make a ruling on whether a decision is right or wrong, then that also becomes a decision. And so there was some clarity needed on that. And on Kavu's, I was just suggesting the idea of the stature of the ombudsman, that it should be very high. Stature has to be elevated. And the details that I suggested were in a manner of speaking. I was not conclusively saying that this and that. Thank you.
Thank you, Siva. And Chris, maybe you should be allowed an opportunity to answer the question from Siva.
I don't make decisions. I make recommendations. There's a very important distinction. What I hope is that if I make a recommendation to the board or one of the other bodies, that they will adopt it. And I haven't often had to make recommendations, but from time to time I do, and the board has respected those. That's very different from a binding decision-making power, and an ombudsman would never have that. Just one other quick thing. In terms of removal, my bylaw says that there has to be a 75% majority of the board to remove the ombudsman. So the protection is
not
there.
Not bad. Okay, so I think it's really fleshing out this discussion, and it's very useful. Overall, taking all these items into account, I repeat what I've said earlier, and what was actually coming out of our process discussion. We really need to be quite strict into starting to discuss the requirements, agreeing on requirements before getting into developing any solution or tools to address this. Otherwise, we're not going to be efficient with our own time. We're not going to be cost efficient, and we will definitely lose sight of priorities. So that's going to be a challenge. We managed to do that in Workstream 1 by prioritizing and at the requirement level. I think it's going to be essential that we do the same approach with Workstream 2, and there's a lot of excellent substance in our quite short discussions, item by item, but that highlight how much diverse and important the work we have to do still is ahead of us. So I think it's quite a good feeling to finally get into these topics. Let's not underestimate the workload that's ahead of us and remind ourselves that our top priority is to finish Workstream 1, but we can slow start and do the background search and all this volunteer work to make sure that we are up and running as soon as Workstream 1 is finished to get these items underway. With that, we will now turn to our, I think it's almost our last agenda item, which is the resources discussion. It's a discussion where we specifically invited our friends and colleagues from the Board Finance Committee, because, as you know, there have been a number of discussions between the CCWG, the CWG stewardship, the Board Finance Committee, the chartering organizations about the management of the cost of the INR stewardship transition as a whole. And there has been a lot of progress made in terms of reporting on these costs. And one of the examples that's currently on your screen is a focus on the accountability track costs that is published by ICANN on a regular basis now, thanks to Xavier's team. I'm trying to capture where Xavier is in the room, if he is. Okay, you're here. So that's giving us a view on a regular basis about where we stand, and clearly, And purely on a factual basis, if you compare the estimate at the beginning of fiscal year 16, which starts on July 1st, 2015, and ends on June the 30th, 2016, there's a big gap between the estimate and what the real figures are going to be. So that's the key issue here is how to address the fact that there's a gap. It was not predicted. And we want this under control in the future because that's also part of the accountability to be accountable to the way we are spending ICANN's money. And that's a collective responsibility for members, participants, staff, everyone has a voice in this. So there's been a number of discussions. We did discuss this already during previous calls. Our goal today was to first take stock of a proposal that has been pushed forward by the ICANN Board Finance Committee and look at how we will be learning from the past experience to improve the way we are managing resources in the future for the CCWG accountability. So if we go to the next slide. We have received and shared on the list a proposal by the ICANN board to set up a pilot that would first work on developing reliable estimates for the rest of the fiscal year 16. So we still have 3 months to go, basically, if I'm not mistaken. And I'd like to maybe offer Shireen the opportunity to speak to that proposal, that pilot proposal, so that we can consider it together, ask questions if need be, and see how we move forward on this. And I don't think it should be too controversial, but I think it's good for you, Shireen, to introduce the proposal, if you will. Thank you.
Because this is on the public record, I just want to put some historical perspective, if you allow me for a minute. The historical perspective is not being part of our DNA and our multi-stakeholder model to have any one person or any group of people responsible or having the authority to make decisions, including on costs. And also historically, I think the SOs and ACs have not been able to obtain a lot of detailed information about costs of their work, meeting stuff, etc. But the sums involved over the last couple of years and in FY15, FY16, almost to the tune of $25 million, and the future expenditure potentially between $6 to $9 million in FY17, makes us think together collectively. And this is not just the board or the finance committee. I think the SO and AC leaders are, and yourself are on this, is that it would be good practice to produce some reliable estimates and to consider how we can manage costs going forward. This would then represent a real change in culture for the community. But to introduce that change, we better have a step-by-step approach so that we don't jump in one go, but do one step at a time, listen to each other, learn, and then formulate the next step. And the first step is what we called a producing reliable estimate. Why do we need that? So, and then I say, what is the suggested idea collectively by the SOs and AC leaders and yourself we talk to? To get a project of any magnitude going requires a real transparent dialogue between all of the parties concerned, from those that request the resources. For example, it could be the SO and AC chairs. They request resources, let's say, for Workstream 2. The SO and AC chairs that then has to evaluate this request, and then the board that has to then fulfill its fiduciary responsibility by saying, are these estimates reasonable, and how are they included in the annual budget? For this conversation to be, and this dialogue to be really transparent and meaningful and effective, we need some reliable estimates, okay? And to get those reliable estimates, it's hard to do it on a part-time basis. It's hard to do it on a sort of ad hoc basis. And the idea here is that why don't we pilot the idea of putting a small team together consisting of project management experience, some legal management experience, financial planning and administration. And that group is not a decision-making body. That group is not a management body. That group is only a support body and for a short period of time. And we would ask for this team to do two things. One is to look back on historical expenditure and learn from there how and where we spent our money, where we could be more efficient, what assumptions drove the expenditure, and then take those and be in a position to project future expenditure and produce reliable estimates for us. So that's the whole idea about producing those estimates in this way. And then we think that could take 4 to 6 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. I don't think it should take much longer than that. And then once we have information and data, we can then group together again and decide what do we do with it and how do we go forward with it and continue this open dialogue and transparent dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sherin, and I want through you to thank the Board Finance Committee for their and Xavier for their continued engagement on this topic. I think it's extremely useful to insert this into the way we manage the group as we move forward. I'd like to ask whether there are any questions for clarifications or reactions to this proposal, which, once again, to me, does not seem particularly controversial. I am seeing Siva's hand up. Siva. No, I don't hold the hand. So, Rudolf.
It's not a question for Shireen, but more a remark or a reaction. I think it's good to have those estimates, first of all. But I think in the future, we also need another kind of estimates. And I think many of us in our normal day jobs would always require those if we ask external consultants to pursue a certain subject, for instance, or deliver an answer on a particular question. We will ask this consultant, how much is this going to cost for you to figure it out? And this is something that we have never done in Workstream 1, as far as I know. We were just asking the legal advisors questions without knowing how much it would cost to get the answer. I think that's another estimate we will need in Workstream 2. If we have a particular question and we want an external consultant or a group to chase an answer, to deliver an answer to us, we ask them an estimate first.
That's a very good point, Rudolf, and we have started doing this for Workstream 1 implementation and the bylaw draftings. We did receive estimates that we've used to provide the Board Finance Committee with insights, I think, back in Dublin. We started this in Dublin, and so we had received estimates, and we also requested an update on estimates to the lawyers in the call we've had recently on how to on the Workstream 1 implementation and the bylaw drafting. But that's certainly a practice that we need to develop more and more as our project moves from everything is urgent and we need the answer now to a phase where we have more time so we can proceed with more caution on that aspect. Do you want to follow up?
And I think in addition to that, it would be good if we budget beforehand, because although the money should not restrict the quality of our work, I think it will help us to stay focused if we know that there is a limit to the amount that we can spend figuring out things.
So stay tuned for the next slide.
Rolf, this is tied closely to the conversation that we had earlier. This draft project plan with the different stages also helps us to get the groups get focused on what they're trying to achieve and discipline their interaction with both the CCWG and then through the CCWG with external advisors. So we want to get more structure in that in order to avoid crunch times over weekends and stuff like that, which makes things extremely costly. And so we can help spread the workload and do proper cost management.
Yeah,
cost
I think control. Many of us do this in their day jobs. If you want a group to deliver an answer of a certain quality within a certain time, you give them a deadline and a fixed budget. It helps keeping them focused.
Robin.
Thank you. This is Robin Gross for the record. I just had a question about this proposal. I'm wondering who the project manager, the lead legal manager, the financial manager, the project administrator, who would they report to and take their direction from? Is it the CEO? Is it ICANN staff? Or would it be the co-chairs that would be directly overseeing and to whom these people would report and ultimately be accountable?
So, Sharon would like to answer that?
Very good question, Robin. I think at this stage, it doesn't really matter. Their job is to do some analysis for all of us. They have to work with the co-chairs and be support to them. They have to work with the finance department to get information from them. So their job is to produce estimates at this stage. Once we have estimates, the next stage would be, okay, what do we do with it? Because let's say we get estimates and project gets approved and then we go into execution. After this, there has to be some form of reporting against these estimates. We can make that decision later. At this stage, this is just a short 4 to 6 weeks project just to produce some historical analysis of historical expenditure and produce estimates for the future. Where it reports, I personally think, is not relevant at this point in time.
Thank you. And a follow-up by Robin.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to suggest that I think it's important that these people would report to the co-chairs and who report to the community. And so in keeping with the bottom-up spirit that we operate under, I think it's important that that's to whom they ultimately report. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Robin. Next is Jordan, and I will close the queue after Cavus.
Yeah, lucky co-chairs managing some more people. Good on you. Look, I think insofar as it goes, this proposal is fine. It's always good to get some support in doing some estimates and in quizzing the lawyers and so on. The thing I don't know, because it's presented as a first start, is where the board's mind is about what follows up on it. And I think certainly we have to avoid a situation where control of resources is used. You know, we have to set a reasonable cap on the cost of this project and then stick to it. But what we can't do is have the workflow decided outside this group. So there's no point in a mix of board members and SOAC chairs deciding a budget quantum for this group that doesn't allow it to do the job that it needs to do. So as long as that isn't the kind of end game, I strongly support getting better info. I think that it's been our own working method with our external counsel that's been the biggest, most egregious driver of costs here. And as long as we do work and then ask them to comment on it rather than asking them random questions, some of which are highly irrelevant, and doing so again and again and again, we'll be much better off in the next phase.
Thank you, Jordan. Cavus.
Thank you, Matthew. I think we have a 2016 budget, and we should work within that limit, number one. Unless there is a procedure that asks additional budget, I don't know how they do it. And second, we don't need to create a post-project manager or so on and so forth. Everything will be under the control or supervision of the co-chairs. This time, the co-chairs should be a little bit more cautious. Not every question raised by the people going directly to the legal counsel, they should think it over whether sometimes the question could be replied internally. And if it is really goes to the area beyond the qualification or capability of the group, then it will go to the council. So this time we should be quite efficient, effective, economical, and take care of that thing. We have heard today, this morning, that we don't have any problem with budget. I don't think so. Always budget must be spent efficiently and economically and appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. Chirin will respond, but that's an excellent segue into the next slide. Chirin.
I think the word, and it's probably my fault, the word project manager, legal manager, is not correct. What we need here is skills in producing project plans, skills in legal planning, and how to get costings from a legal. And all, that's what we need. We don't need managers to do this. We just need people with the experience, that have skills to produce these estimates. So it is my fault. The word manager is the wrong manager here. It's more like a project planner, legal planner, financial planner. That's what I meant. So.
Okay. Well, I think with that, we can certainly first welcome the proposal by the Board Finance Committee, gladly accept it as a pilot, and obviously then we'll report and share experience once the pilot is achieved. We have estimates. We'll see how we can make this move efficient moving forward. And Cavus was already touching on the next slide, which is what adjustments we would have with regards to the legal expenses. And if we can go to the next slide. I think most of the ideas have been circulated already. It hasn't been our practice to take legal requests straight to the lawyers from everyone, but certainly in the stretch to the compromise, it's been sometimes very challenging for the lawyers to answer the questions in very short turnaround times, and also very difficult to have a constructed discussion with the whole group before handing over a specific request, which was basically especially designed to reassure a particular stakeholder about the consequences of a particular compromise or things like this. So hopefully we can move away from that. I was going a little too fast. So we have three different type of expenses, face-to-face meetings such as this one, staff support, legal advice. That's basically what we have. We have discussed in a previous meeting, sometimes in February, that going forward, we will still need staff support. I think we can confirm that. We will still need face-to-face meetings before the ICANN meeting, such as this one. And I think the breadth of discussions on Workstream 2 would tend to confirm that we will still need this kind of setting to get together, agree on requirements, probably agree on recommendations later on. We will also might have a need for that for Workstream 1 implementation, which is our top priority in June. So I think that's still part of our request. And legal advice might be needed, although it should be less intensive than it has been so far. And that's where I go to the next slide. So we've identified ways to optimize those costs or those expenses. One is that, first of all, we should be less intense. So, and it's been clear from the lawyers that part of the cost was due to the fact that we were asking for very short turnaround time. They were having to keep their teams ready basically at all times and 24/7 almost. We may also decide on some requests that are not controversial that other types of available legal expertise could do the trick. ICANN Legal has a lot of expertise that in many cases we could also agree that this is perfectly fine to get their input, because probably maybe it has already been provided to the board, it's already existing or things like this. We can use other legal resources. What's important for us is that we have the ability to go to the independent lawyers when we feel the need for that. So I think it's also a pathway to optimize cost. Since we'll be working in drafting teams, design teams, the question that will be raised is whether these teams have direct access to legal advice or need to go through a gating process. Certainly, our proposed approach is a gating process, as it is now, it's the co-chairs acting, and some transparency requirements about the requests that are being prepared and the responses that are provided. And so we are suggesting that we keep this process moving forward with more leeway for the lawyers to define the turnaround time so that we don't get the peak costs associated to urgent requests. And we believe that this should help lower the intensity of these costs moving forward. And I think this is already this proposal already sort of captures what you were saying, Cavus, and what others were suggesting. But I'd like to check if there are any specific proposals on this for the management of legal advice moving forward. I have three people in the queue and then Ed. But first, Cavus, or is that an old hand? It's a new
hand. Yes, Matthew, I wanted to make it clear that in my previous comment, in no way I did criticize nor put in question what you, co-chair, have done, nor anybody at all. I am talking of future. So please make it quite clear that this is not my habit to talk about the past nor to criticize anybody. Thank you.
The record is set straight. Next is Sébastien.
Yes, thank you very much, Mathieu. My question is about turnaround time left to lawyers. I understand that we don't want to have something on a very short time and we need to impose some short deadline, but I think we need to have some deadlines because if not, depending on where and when, it could take too much time.
I think that the phrasing is not correct here.
Thank you.
The point here was to say when asking for an estimate and considering the request, we could ask the lawyers how long do they think it's going to take, and of course after that there's a deadline. It's not just you will deliver whenever you want, which is certainly not good practice, whether with lawyers or any other profession. Next is Xavier. Over here.
Thank you, Mathieu. Xavier Calvez speaking. Justin, you may have mentioned it, but I may have missed it. Just an additional suggestion is that the requesting an estimate with the question that is being asked and to define the scope from the legal firm seems to have been an efficient process used by the CWG and that may be considered worthwhile by this group as well to try to optimize the value and the understanding of the costs up front, and that then the group can maybe decide and the co-chairs can decide better how to either proceed or proceed differently with their request to the lawyers. And we will assist with negotiating with the lawyers as to whether they do charge or not fees for their estimates, because I don't think that's going to be accepted as such.
Thank you, Xavier. And you're right to point this out, because that's something that was not in the terms of in the existing contractual framework with the lawyers, so that would need to be clarified with them. I just want to underline that estimates are valuable when the type of request is not it has a significant size, and not if it's only a two-hour request. That's just waste of time for everyone, including the volunteers that would be doing this discussion with the lawyers. So we need to find the right balance. I think Ed, that's where you were in this queue. Please.
Thanks, Natal. excuse me. Back when I was young, when we started this whole thing, I was a member of something called the legal sub-team, which actually hired the lawyers. And actually, to those in the room, I see a few members here. This was actually the finest group of people I've ever worked with here in ICON. Leanne chaired the group. It was intensive, and quite frankly, I think we hired some pretty good lawyers. As we move forward, though, in Workstream 2, I question whether we actually need two law firms. If we're trying to reduce costs, memory serves me correct, one of the law firms is substantially cheaper than the other. I remember in terms of lead counsel, it's almost a differential of 200% of what we paid one lead counsel to what we paid another. And again, I'm not sure what's privileged, I'm not going to quote figures, but there was a difference. And my question going forward into Workstream 2 is, do we need the expertise of both firms? From my perspective, I think Adler Colvin could handle all of this. And that would be a reduced cost to the community and maybe allow us to get a little bit more legal help for a bigger bang for the buck, basically. I don't know if you guys have considered going with one firm in Workstream 2. If not, perhaps you should.
Leon, would you like to answer that?
Yes, Mathieu, thank you. Leon Sanchez. You are right, Ed. I mean, this is something that we haven't yet considered because I don't think that is our role to define whether we go with one law firm or two. We'd rather have the group decide it. It is fair enough that you set the record straight and we are aware in the difference of fees between one law firm and the other. They are substantially higher with one against another. And maybe I am not sure if the right way to go is just to rule out one of the two firms. Depending on the kind of work that we will be carrying out on Workstream 2, we might even be looking at a new firm. I mean, we're not married to either firm, so we... as much as we love them, we're not married to them. So, I don't know, maybe at some point it is worth revisiting the convenience, first, of having two law firms, and then, second, maybe we can either stick to one of either law firms or we could hire another a new one. I don't know. I think that that's something that will come out from the dynamics of the group.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, so I think that's a point of consideration, that whether we should review our current independent legal system as a whole and assess various scenarios, including the cost factor, but not only the cost factor, because there's a skill factor as well, depending on the items that we have to deal with in Workstream 2. And I also want to make clear, I think this, if we go this way, it's only for Workstream 2, because for Workstream 1 implementation, we're not changing anything. I'm seeing a long queue until Bruce, and I close it after Bruce, but Malcolm is next.
Thank you, Mathieu. These suggestions strike me as mostly reasonable and pragmatic. Malcolm Hattie for the record. These suggestions strike me as mostly reasonable and pragmatic. On the turnaround time left to lawyers thing, perhaps I may try to rephrase that slightly, that the instructions to the lawyers would be to propose a time frame to the chairs on the basis of cost minimization, and that we would just leave it to the chairs to ensure that that the time frame was managed in a way that did not become excessive. On that basis, and I see you nodding, Chair, if that were the case, then I would feel quite comfortable with this. The only one that gives me pause is the statement that some requests may be handled by ICANN Legal where no independent view is needed. Now, I may be misrecollecting this, but my recollection is that ICANN Legal has always been of the view that it, together with its corporate external counsel, Jones Day, have always been capable of providing sufficiently independent advice to support this group and never particularly saw the need for us to appoint our own independent counsel. Now, if that's indeed a possible viewpoint that they might have, I wondered how we would go about separating when you thought that ICANN Legal's advice was sufficient.
Well, I think that would be for the various groups and the tracking group to decide, but obviously there may be a trust factor here at some point to be built and enabled. But I think it will depend on the kind of request.
Well, are you suggesting that the considerations as to that trust have changed between Workstream 1 and Workstream 2?
I'm an optimist.
Okay. I'll just leave this at saying this still gives me pause.
Yeah, I understand. That's well noted, Malcolm. That's well noted. Jordan and Ebrot, I noted your hand raised for the end of the queue.
Thanks, Mathieu.
I think we probably do need the two firms, because if there are any bylaws changes coming out of Workstream 2, it would not make sense to have a new lawyer dealing with those, and the balance of skills between the two firms is probably still useful. But if we did a review and found that one of them wasn't used, it would be, as long as it wasn't Sidley, given their bylaws drafting, it would make sense to drop them. I think there's a bit of a cultural issue about the use of the legal support. I think that we should have a general presumption of don't ask and don't say yes. I think we should be looking generally for advice from counsel once we've got relatively well-formed ideas that can then be tested in whole, rather than nagging with detailed questions about issues that probably the marginal benefit to the project or the work from finding out the answer is much lower than the marginal cost of providing the answer. So certainly, I mean, I'm ruled out from running any of these work groups, which is great as far as I'm concerned, but I think people should definitely not be looking for legal advice until there's something to get a considered view, a kind of one-stop, yes, this will work, and here are some tweaks answer.
Very good point, Jordan. Thank you. Cavus?
Yes, Matthew. I think the three bullets you have written need a little bit of improvement. One way of reading of that each group requests for a legal things and sharing on the list among the people within the team. The other is that they submit such a thing in a written to the co-chairs, and that is the co-chairs who share it on the list with everybody, and once received the comment but not approved, the co-chair decide to certify or not. So that is the, we would like to make it quite clear that this is the co-chair who decide for certifications to submit that to that, but not the CCWG group, because you don't want to waste time to go to the consensus and so on and so forth. This is your ability and your competence to decide, yes, you need that sort of the things. So could you make it kindly clarify the issue?
We will attempt to do so while protecting the requirement that requests are also transparent to the whole group, so that the whole group is aware of the request that is being prepared, which was our intent when we said CCWG here. So we'll try to find a better wording for that. Kavus, I fully agree that there's room for improvement. Bruce, you are next.
Yes, thank you, Matthew. I just want to pick up on a couple of things. One is, in managing legal costs, what most commercial organisations and probably non-profits as well will generally use in-house counsel for sort of routine legal work, and then they use external counsel for very specialised areas, and often from different law firms. In other words, you're not generally with any particular external law firm. And so your internal counsel is actually able to help formulate the questions properly and use the external law firms cost-effectively and for their particular expertise. So I think that it's come to the top. If we look at the amount of money that we're spending on legal, it seems to me that we need to have an in-house legal function that's supporting the CCWG. Then there's the issue of separation of duties. Before I joined the board, I was chair of the GNSO, and before that I was chair of the DNSO, for those that know all the acronyms. Back then we went through a number of different phases. So initially, the DNSO employed its own staff entirely independently of ICANN. Then we actually ended up having ICANN employ a support person at that stage, which was Glenn de Saint-Géry. But then the policy support was still basically out of the General Counsel's office, which is Louis Touton at the time. And I pushed when I was chair at that time that we needed a separation of duty. We needed a separate policy support staff, and that staff was built in Brussels, so completely separate to the Los Angeles office. And I think those, you know, people on the GNSO now, probably most of you don't remember those days, but my sense is that GNSO Council trusts the policy support that it gets, because there's a clear separation of duties. Those policy people in the Brussels office and at different offices have nothing to do with the normal sort of corporate function. They're not part of ACRM's team, they're not part of John Jeffrey's team. They report into David Olive, and it's a complete separation of duties. I think that there's a way forward here in having your own in-house legal counsel that is not reporting into John Jeffrey's team, but actually reports into David Olive and is just part of the support that we provide our policy team. So I do urge you to seriously consider that, because I think that will both give you confidence that you're dealing with a legal counsel that's working on your behalf, and also allow that legal counsel to manage the external firms and choose external firms with specialist skills. If we look at the Workstream 2 topics, they're really quite diverse. The sort of law firm that will give you advice on how to manage sort of document disclosure policies versus the sort of law firm that can provide human rights specialist advice are generally not the same law firm. So you know, I would suggest you want more diversity in the external law firms that you use, but you need an in-house counsel to basically sort of manage the day-to-day questions that the group may have. But make a separation of duties that in-house counsel is operating as part of the policy support function of ICANN and is independent of the normal corporate operational services in the general counsel's office or in the domain name or IANA offices.
Thank you, Bruce. Want you a short response?
Yes,
Thomas.
Very briefly, Bruce. Thanks so much for bringing that up. And I guess it's not the appropriate time for our group to discuss this, but we will put out the question on the list for you to share your views on having a separate legal advisor for us that's not reporting to JJ. You know, whether we accept your suggestion, I think that's really worthwhile discussing. We would need some time before that person gets operational. You know, we would need to put out job ads and what have you. So I think we should try to get a group's view and an agreement on that as soon as possible. But we'll do that on the list, so watch out for that threat.
Thank you, Thomas. And that was the thread and not the threat, right? Thank you.
Both.
Ebrard, you were next, and then Asha.
Okay, I just wanted to comment on two things. I don't agree really with what Malcolm Mahati says. Jonas Day may be entitled to their opinion, and I know they are sometimes wrong, but they're never in doubt about their opinion. I also want to comment on what Bruce said. We have two lawyers on the co-chairs, and he's basically saying that the two lawyers on the as co-chairs cannot sort this out for themselves. A lawyer is responsible to the person who pays him. We had this discussion in the beginning, and we said that we wanted external counsel because we were not really confident about the direction or the advice. And I think that's a decision that the group must make. And I hear what Thomas has just said. I don't really think we need an in-house counsel that will not improve the situation as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Ebrard. Asha?
Thank you, Matthew. Asha Hemrajani for the record. So I've read all the chats in the window, and I've heard what people have been saying today, but I just want to go back to how we started this discussion. So what the board is proposing is that we set up a support team, and this support team is going to help us come up with estimates of the cost and of the work and the costs, related costs, for the work for the rest of Workstream 1 and for Workstream 2. We're not talking about hiring additional lawyers. We're talking about people to help us with the planning or people to help the co-chairs with the estimates. It's very important we have estimates because we cannot go into this blindly. We have to know how much work is going to be involved and how much we're going to spend. It's important that we know how much we're going to spend. That is the purpose of this proposal. Just wanted to remind everyone of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Asha. And I think we've agreed on the proposal, but we're already looking one step further here on the way forward as well.
Yes, but I wanted to clarify the point about there was some discussion going on about hiring an in-house lawyer and all that. In the proposal, we're talking about a planner.
That's very clear. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying. So I had closed the queue on this, but Jordan and Robin, was that
an immediate response that cannot wait for the list discussion? No. Okay, old hand, and Robin, old hand as well. New hand. So, Robin.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to make a suggestion on this about the way that the lawyers are currently managed. I think it would be useful if we went back to using the CCWG legal list to manage the lawyers, because that is publicly archived, so we can be more transparent that way, and the co-chairs can still manage the lawyers, but it'll show the community, it'll show the board that we're doing all that we can to manage the costs, and that we're being transparent and open in our managing of these very sensitive issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. And that's actually also a good segue into our next, and I think it's the last slide. I wish. Some people wish. About how we can address the planning of costs a little bit more efficiently and clarify the roles and responsibilities of each of the parties in this process, managing the cost of the project going forward. And the idea here is to introduce some form of iterative approach, which could run, each iteration could be from one ICANN meeting to another, so that it actually involves some face-to-face discussions. And I think the principles that are behind this are, and that's on the top, that it's incumbent upon us as a CCWG to define what we want to achieve in the upcoming periods. What are the goals we're setting for ourselves? For instance, in the next period, we want to provide the bylaw drafts for Workstream 1. And this is the support we estimate reliably that we need to get that done. So that's on the top. If you go slightly right, I think it would be great and very useful, because it is, after all, for them, we are accountable to the chartering organizations, to chime in and say, oh, we think this goal is, that the value of these goals is actually, there's value for money in doing this, so we're in favor, or we think that given the other projects going on, if you could do that, maybe with a little more, being a little more aware of the cost, or maybe reducing a little bit your ambitions, because we have other things and we need to be aware of the global impact for the cost of ICANN, that would be, then that's why I think ICANN meetings are useful, because many chartering organizations can only make these kind of discussions in the face-to-face meetings. Then it's clearly ICANN board's responsibility to allocate the funds, update the budget, and I would note that once Workstream 1 is in place, if we're unhappy about their decisions, we have ways to hold them accountable. So it's not just the board can do whatever it wants. It's really a discussion that we need to have. We need some improvements in the tracking of expenses, and that's the point behind the additional skills in support for the project cost tracking. And obviously this doesn't work out if there's no reporting about what we've achieved and how much we've spent in the process. And I think if we could clarify these roles and responsibilities and set up this kind of loop efficiently, then we would be in a much better position to assess at any point in time what's the value of keeping the project open, what would we miss if we didn't have any more resources on the project, and obviously find all the balance in between, which is what's valuable about the project. So I think we've already started working on the top aspect here, which is the estimates based on the proposal by the both finance committee. And putting that into this kind of perspective would certainly help moving forward, ensuring that everyone is clear about each other's roles and responsibilities, but also has visibility at any point in time about where we're going and why we're spending money and how we are actually making this. I am, it's not written on the slide, but it was mentioned earlier about the idea of a budget cap. I think whether we want it or not, there are budget caps in ICANN's existing processes. If you go over the amount that is in the budget, obviously the board has to give make a new decision. So there is a budget cap right now, and I think this process can accommodate this quite well by the discussion between the CCWG, the chartering organizations, and the ICANN board. So that's, I think that's the wider view about how to move things forward. And this is probably, if the group agrees, something that we could try and also explain in the various discussions that I have no doubt will take place during this ICANN meeting in Marrakesh about the expenses of the INS stewardship transition project and how we see it moving forward. I think this is a good starting point for these discussions. And that's the introduction for that purpose. And I don't know if there are any reactions in the room or if you are too tired to react at this point, which was our goal, having this as the last slide. I see Shireen's reaction. Shireen is not that tired yet.
No. I just want to say I really like this and support it wholeheartedly. And the reason for that is just, it goes back to what I said earlier. This is about a dialogue between all of us. And it's an iterative process. You keep going. And if one party doesn't like something, they need to discuss with the others, go back, adjust, do trade-offs, and we move on collectively as a group. So I fully support that. Thank you.
Thank you, Shireen. Kavus?
Yes, Matthew, we are not tired. At least I never be tired of anything at all. I think there is always a benefit that we consult colleagues. So whatever decision you want to take, and you, if you think that you could consult CCWG, please do that. Whatever decision you want to make, and if you deem appropriate that you consult the board, please do that. So do not exclude that. It's not harmful to get views of the people, whether you think that that views could be implemented or not, but at least it is better. It gives you more support. It brings richness and so on and so forth. So do not limit only to the three. Consult CCWG, and when appropriate and necessary, consult the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. Abroad.
I have an improvement proposal. I think we should remove four of these buttons and change the one left over with cut legal fees. The costs that we're having are not the meeting fees, are not the staff support. They are less than 8% or something. Admin costs are 1% or something. The lobby fees shouldn't be the lobbyist fees shouldn't be lumped into this project because we have no control over this. Of the fees that where we have some form of controls, the only contributing factor that is actually starting to mess with Xavier's sleep is the legal fees. So we must find whatever way, we must find a way of lowering those costs, and then it will all come together. I'm not, as I said, a budget cap, as far as I'm concerned, is helpful because it gives us something to look at, but it's not going to shape the substance of our discussion in the end.
Thanks, Ebrard. And that was precisely the previous discussion. And I think this kind of system also creates a consistent incentive of cutting the legal fees if that's the input from the chartering organization, from our group and the ICANN board. Yes, please go for
what I mean is we shouldn't spend too much time on this iterative administrative approach when the actual cost factor that we only cost factor that we really need to be concerned about is the legal fees. If we get them down to a manageable level, all this we can dispense with. If we had gotten them down to a manageable level, we wouldn't have to put in another project to contain these costs. I'm not arguing about the actual value of the proposal of this project management team, but the goal behind it is very clearly that we are very expensive. And the financial manager is getting concerned about where he's getting the money from because it will interfere with long-term planning that they're having.
Thank you, Ebrard.
Your point. I understand your point. Cavus, was that a new hand? No. So, Avery?
Thank you. Avery speaking. I guess looking at it, I mean, it looks like, you know, very healthy bureaucratic overhead. But I worry about trying to go through this entire cycle every 3 months. I think we're just creating more work. We're asking for more staff time and such. So I think having the idea of a cycle of five things periodically makes sense, but I really do worry about this being a constant cycle that's going on in the background of the work we're doing. Thanks.
So it could certainly, the cycle could run over 2 meetings, for instance, to make it smoother. Okay. Thanks for your sharing. A last word on this before we go to the closing remarks.
Yes, I think people may read this chart in a different way. There isn't a constant looping over 3 months period to do this. What this says is that CCWG define a request, the SO and ACs approve the value of it, and the board allocate the resources. That's done. The left side of the chart is during the duration of a project, no matter how long it takes, a year or more, there should be some reporting and some feedback on the achievements. That's all there is to it. So, Avery, this is not a big overhead, nor... Yeah, I think... I think Mathieu would agree with that. This is... So you may want...
I think let's do it once and we'll see whether that's a heavy burden or not. And then we'll see, we'll adjust this. As Everard was saying, maybe by the time we do it once, there won't be any budget issue anymore because we'll be done. But I wish it's the case. Okay, so thank you very much for the discussion. I know it was a hard discussion to have after a long day, after you had long trips in the previous days. And certainly the energy in the room sort of started dipping. Yeah, it must be my energy, yes. But I think it's important that we have these elements in mind, all of us, and especially the members who will discuss with their respective organizations. And I'm certain there will be a number of questions on budget. So it's important that we have aligned our views on this and can demonstrate that we have a plan moving forward to manage costs effectively, and that this is something we're taking very seriously as a group. And with that, I'd like to turn to Thomas for some closing remarks. From what I hear, they should be short.
And that is certainly true. Now, just to briefly recap, you know, this has been a long day, but I think it has been a very fruitful day. Best news today is that 2 chartering organizations have approved, that there are no dark clouds approaching from other areas, at least not that we're aware of. So hopefully we'll be able to really celebrate next Thursday. We got more clarity on Workstream 1 implementation by sorting out the question of what's going to happen with implementation oversight. We've clarified the role of the IRP team. We've made a demarcation to Workstream 2, we've discussed the substantive issues. The most important takeaway for me during the substantive discussion on what's going to fall into these topics is that we've clarified what we're not going to do. So I think we've set expectations as to what the scope of work is going to be for the Workstream 2 discussions. We are now in a position, after we've discussed with you the process and approach, working methodologies, as well as cost and budget approach, we're now in a position to come up with a proposal on how to approach Workstream 2. So I think we can signal to the outside world something that's very important. Workstream 1 is coming. It's not being put on the back burner. We got it rolling basically today. We're going to issue a call for volunteers, hoping to get some fresh blood to the scene to get the work started on these important areas. So with that, I'd like to close the day, although I can't. Cavus has raised his hand.
Yes. Thank you very much, co-chairs.
for your contributions, for your preparation of documents and so on and so forth. Thanks to ICANN and the staff for the material they prepared for us. Thanks to the board members who are present here, contributed. And one plea to the people, let us take the ESAC example in approving the proposal of CCWG. Short, concise, precise. We agree with that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. So you stole my thunder in thanking certain people, but I would like to add to that. You know, you mentioned members, participants, staff, our advisors. Let me add the interpreters. Let me add the scribes. Let me add the remote participants. I mean, it's so hard to follow conversations for so many hours. So let's give them a round of applause. Don't forget, we have the engagement session on Monday, and we have another working session on Thursday. See you there. Thank you very much. Bye.